Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
What's good, internet? It is not Monday. It's not Monday. It's Tuesday, October 31st, and you're listening to Waypoint 101. This is not the Waypoint 101 you think it is. It is not our second Wolfenstein episode. You can tell that because, one, Patrick Klepek is not joining us today. Instead, it is me. It is Danielle Rienda.
Hi, hi.
And it is our very own senior editor, Robert Zachney.
Good evening, everybody.
And we are here to talk about Replicants. We are here to talk about a spoiler-filled, fun, thoughtful, hopefully, retrospective long look back at Blade Runner 2049, a movie that came out just this past month, but that we've been kind of waiting to get the free time to chat about. I think we've all been itching to talk about it as big fans of the genre, as fans of the original. Are we all fans of the original Blade Runner?
Yeah, I think we're pretty diehard. Like, I just saw it, the final cut on Blu-ray the other week.
Okay.
Well, a few weeks ago at this point, and was surprised by how much I did, in fact, like it.
It's good. You know, I still like it.
It had been a little while, and I was a little worried, right? That like this was going to be the viewing when the magic dissipated.
Yeah, which is always a possibility, and I, like a scientist, always do my best to hold open the possibility that future experiments will reveal that my past findings were incorrect. That like, hey, my tastes have changed. I missed something in a film that makes me hate it. You know, and I think it's probably fair to say that there are lots of people who have very complicated feelings about the original film. I certainly do. It's both my favorite movie and also one that I think has a lot of glaring issues, one that's hard to recommend. And I actually wrote about the context of why I love Blade Runner so much, the original. Going into this this sequel, and why I was so apprehensive about it. But then that movie came out, and I saw it. How recently have we all seen Blade Runner 2049?
I think it was opening weekend, actually,
okay,
that I saw it. And yeah, just to go on what we said before, I've seen the original, two different cuts of the original in two different formats, including pan and scan on a CRT.
Oh, that's how you're supposed to see it.
That's your most recent one, correct?
That was my most recent. Well, no, actually, I saw that like 2 weeks ago, and then last week I watched final director's cut, the 2007
right, the final cut,
with Patricia. So I watch that movie like 8 times a year or something ridiculous.
Yeah, it's probably the only movie that I have seen countless times, and that I've seen it so many times I've lost count. I'm not a rewatcher. I'm not someone who like goes back to fond stuff and like digs back in regularly.
Really?
There's just too much. There's just too much good stuff that I haven't seen, you know? Like,
yeah.
There's a small collection, 3 or 4 things that I will rewatch. It's like Blade Runner, Home Movies, the TV show.
That's a great show.
It's my favorite TV show, I think. I will rewatch something if I'm exposing somebody else to it. So like my rewatches of The Wire have only been like, oh man, you haven't seen The Wire? We should watch The Wire this weekend. Stuff like that. A couple of Gundam shows, but mostly the very short ones, not like long series. And then like one or two other movies that I care deeply about, but like there's too much I want to see. I want to see new stuff. Or if I'm writing about it, I'll revisit. You know, it's like, okay, if it's time to put the studious Austin hat on, then I'll go back in and then I'll do deep dives. But Rob, are you a rewatcher? Are you a...
Yeah, like... not quite compulsively so, although there's definitely, you know, there's those comfort food movies that occasionally I end up going back to. But like in general, I think I tend to revisit things a lot for a couple reasons. But the big one being that I am just not an amazing critical viewer the first time around or even the second. Like for me, I actually start like getting so much out of those repeated viewings that it considerably deepens and changes my appreciation and understanding of a work. So for me, it's like, if I'm actually going to, like, say I've really seen a movie or I really get it, I need to have seen it a few times.
Yeah.
Which I'm a little apprehensive, right? Because I only had the one chance to see 2049. And I've got a good dozen viewings or so of Blade Runner behind me.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm eager to... I need to go see it again before it's out of IMAX in New York, because it's a beautiful film, 2049. I think it's, like, the thing that even the people who I think disagree with the content of the film, the narrative content, the acting, the soundtrack, stuff like that, the way it handles its themes. I have spoken to very few people who don't walk away going, man, what a pretty looking movie. And so I really want to see it in IMAX before it leaves. So it will immediately ascend to being in the rare group of, like, movies I make myself go see twice.
Yes.
So initial thoughts, I guess let's just dive into it a little bit. And unless someone wants to give a little more context, in terms of expectations, maybe what were you both expecting going into this film? Again, I've written about it. If you're curious what my expectations were, you can go read that piece. But I'm curious about, for you, Danielle and Rob, like, what were your expectations like?
I probably had fairly tempered expectations at this point. For a while, I actually was going to movies and reviewing them, sort of as part of my job. And so for a little while, for a couple of years there, I was going to everything and seeing everything and sort of keeping up on movie gossip and, you know, maybe not all of the movie gossip, but quite a bit of it. You know, I was going to the Oscar parties and, you know, taking, if not bets, at least I had opinions about how things were going in Hollywood. So I was sort of in that world for a while, and then I've really sort of mercifully stopped being in that world to some degree, but I can never turn off the sort of critic hat whenever I'm watching something. It's almost as if, like, I can't turn off the part of my brain that's writing a review every time I watch something with any kind of nerd factor to it. So that's always going to be part of it. But I had stayed away from sort of the hype regarding the movie. I had stayed away from previews. I had stayed away from, you know, teasers. I had stayed away from all the gossip and all that kind of stuff, because I just, at this point, I didn't think there was anything that was going to top the original Blade Runner for me in terms of what it did well. Basically, I sort of go back and forth in my head whether or not this or Alien, the original Alien, which is my favorite movie of all time, by the way, whether this or Alien had the best production design in any movie ever of all time.
This
forever.
Being 2049.
No, sorry. The original Blade Runner.
Gotcha. Okay.
Like, whether or not, you know, basically. I think those are two of the most beautifully shot, just gorgeously, gorgeously designed films in terms of everything that goes on in the frame. I see something new every time. And that's why I can watch Blade Runner 100 times and see something new in the frame every single time I go.
What's interesting about that too is those are two films that they're deeply influential, but not deeply is actually a funny word for me to use there. extremely influential, but not deeply influential, yes, in the sense that the depth of their production design, the depth of the visual iconography that they use, the complexity of what might show up on the screen, the softness of some of those spaces, the clutteredness, yes, the actual lived-in senses are not often actually dredged up and actually, you know, echoed. Normally what you get is big neon signs from Blade Runner, flying cars,
and
from
a little
Blade
bit
Runner.
Of greebling, and that's it.
Right. Yeah. And then from Alien, you get, like, really what you get is aliens, right? Get space marines, you get cool guns.
Light filtered through fans.
From both, actually. That's
Ridley Scott's thing.
Totally.
He's like, oh, this lighting rig needs
yes,
a big
exactly.
turbine.
We'll come back to that, because I think that this movie does that super well, actually. Yeah. The 2049. So what about you, Rob? What were your expectations going in?
Yeah, they were kind of all over the map. So I have still not seen Arrival, which I feel like is kind of a glaring oversight. But I was a huge fan of Sicario.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which is, to be clear, these are films from the director, Denis
Villeneuve.
Villeneuve, yeah.
Yeah. And so what I liked about Sicario is that there's sort of a... He has a very, like, icy cinematic gaze is the way I would put it. Like, his subjects are not You sort of regard your subjects at a remove. There's almost a sort of clinical matter of factness,
right,
to Villeneuve's eye, and I thought that was really that like pointed in a positive direction for Blade Runner. Because I think, to your point, there's this danger with the world of Blade Runner that people will become mesmerized by the false glamour of it.
Yes.
You know, by the light, by the imagery, by its, you know, sheer majesty. And what I was sort of excited about with Villeneuve taking it over is that's not really what he's, like, historically been into. Like, he's got an eye for an image, right, but he actually tends to underplay rather than overplay. And so I was kind of excited to see, like, not only is he an exciting director, but he was kind of somebody who I felt would not be excessively beholden to the original work. Like, the last thing I'd want here is, like, a J.J. Abrams character taking over.
Fuck.
And being like, oh, just, I'm the biggest fan. I just, everyone on this team just loves the original so much. I didn't want that.
Mm-hmm. Did you get it? What did you think?
Oh, man.
Let's talk. Let's dive in.
Dive in.
All right, so I think, well, first reaction, holy shit, is the audio mix for the IMAX loud.
Oh, is it? Okay, I'll know that going in.
Yeah, be careful. Like, I might actually, this is the rare movie I might actually recommend earplugs for.
Okay.
Because, like, it was, I saw it in the, okay, quick detail. So around here in Boston, Austin, we have this furniture store called Jordan's Furniture.
Oh my God, mm-hmm. That's right.
Are you familiar with this?
Yeah,
is this legend made it down
the
there?
IMAX theater is in the Jordans. I remember this.
Yeah. So there's these two stores, Jordan's Furniture, and he's like this eccentric like furniture magnate. Just selling like these are like several aircraft hangar sized like furniture stores. Like there is a football field's worth of sofas alone if you want it. And that leads into the love seat room, which is another football field just of love seats. The other thing these stores are known for, each one has an IMAX theater. And
each one?
Yeah.
Each one. Yeah. How many are there?
There's just these two massive superstores, one north of Boston, one west of Boston. And they're huge. And actually, quietly, like some of the best movie theaters in the area. They're actually really well-maintained IMAX theaters.
Seating, right? So
Believe me, he makes it a point. You can use the same Tempur-Pedic seating.
Oh my God!
That you can find on the showroom at Jordan's Furniture. But so it was an incredibly loud mix. So use caution if you're going to an IMAX. But at first, I think what I really enjoyed about it is I felt entirely disoriented. This felt discontinuous from Blade Runner. And it wasn't afraid of letting me like sit with that feeling for a while, which I really appreciated. Like, it established its own story and its own world, I think, pretty well before really starting to show how it ties back to the original work, which
That's an interesting
was helpful.
Point. Yeah. In that, you know, it's a film that, I mean, ironically, it actually opens on, like, let me put on the fucking, like, hardcore fan hat, but it opens with a scene that is from, that was cut from the original Blade Runner that was never shot. The sequence of visiting the farm, so it opens with Officer K arriving at a grub farm out on the outskirts I guess it's on the outskirts of California, of Los Angeles, presumably,
yeah.
Slightly northern or central California. This very like gray, washed out like single home that's next to some places where grubs, synthetic grubs, some sort of protein farm basically. And again, also huge solar panels just dotting the ground. And one, obviously, that is a callback to the oil fields that I talk about way too often. When I talk about Blade Runner opening on burning oil fields, it's like ground.
Do we want to talk at all about the crawl before we get too far into this?
Oh, sure. What was I don't even remember the crawl.
Oh, that's important.
It's been a month since I've seen
it's
it.
Okay.
So, like, remind me of the crawl.
I mean, it's very similar to the first movie. It just kind of gives you that little bit of context. It says
okay, I didn't know if there was
it says something about how, you know, Nexus 8's Or the new replicants, which already sort of sets up that, oh, they don't die in 4 years now. So that's an important little detail.
Well, I mean,
and
like,
then
that's we'll definitely get into that as we talk about Officer K's living situation, because I think what was earned by the previous generation of Nexus models is important for sure.
Very, very.
But the two things right off the bat is like, one, it does literally reuse this sequence of going to try to arrest this escaped this replicant living in hiding, who is cooking soup. Like, there's this I just have such clear memories of the storyboards of this sequence that was cut from the original Blade Runner, where Deckard was supposed to go arrest a replicant who is a farmer who was living out in the outskirts of town cooking soup. And, like, seeing that sequence brought to life, but just a bit askew, because immediately you recognize Officer K is no Deckard.
Right.
They make it very clear right away that he is a replicant. They say, you know, you must be one of the newer models. He deals with this character, who is played by the former wrestler Dave Bautista, really well. He deals with him very efficiently and very, like, coolly. I mean, he gets beat up a little bit too, but then is just like, no, this is done. And he's kind of got an attitude, like Gosling's character, Officer K.
He's like a Western anti-hero in ways. Like, he shows up like he is a veteran gunslinger, an experienced killer.
Yeah.
And he just goes about it with, look, sorry to ruin your day.
Yeah.
But I'm here.
And it's the end. Deckard is the Philip Marlowe stand-in, the kind of, like, you know, has had a bad day, he's not wearing his favorite coat, doesn't want to be doing the job, can't trust anybody, even himself, then I do think that Gosling's Officer K is a lot more continental operative.
Oh my God, I'm so glad you went there. Yes.
Of course, right? Like, is the person who has cracked knees, who has pulled triggers, has that professional experience and disconnect at the start of the film, almost disinterested in his own work, right?
He's a little bit Ringo from Stagecoach, if you want to pull that one out.
Totally, yeah, totally. I think that the solar panels are great because it doesn't erase the past. It literally has been tiled over, right? The oil fields have been replaced by just too many solar panels, like so many solar panels that it feels like it's an act of contrition almost, right? Which is the right way to think about the technocratic way of thinking about dealing with environmental change.
Yes. Established in that sort of crawl is that it's instead of Tyrell, who has literally taken over Tyrell's corporation, is this guy Neander Wallace.
Yeah, Neander, yes. Interesting name. Wallace, very boring name, and I think immediately sets up the shadow of being in the shadow of Tyrell, right? Like, yeah. Tyrell Corporation is just more interesting as a science fiction name than Wallace Industries or whatever. Yeah. And I love that. I actually think that that is a small little thing, but I hope that that was intentional.
Yeah, it's gotta be.
Well, and something else in that opening is that there is a squalid griminess to everything we see. Mm. In that, like, this farm, it's not just foggy. It's, like, in this miasma.
Right.
Of just, like, it almost looks like somebody's burning white phosphorus just off camera or something. Right. Like, right. It's just this choking, thick white fog. There's the grub farm where he's a farmer, sure, but, like, he's going into basically this, like, climate controlled like hab facility and like rooting around in this dirt for basically like juicy maggots.
Right.
And then his farmhouse is just this tiny little Quonset hut almost. It looks very much like something you'd find abandoned after a war. But I think what this further establishes is that Blade Runner, that world tried to seduce you and overpower you. Like, there were ugly and horrible things about it, but at the same time, it was dazzling. Here, that veneer has worn away, either because of the catastrophes or just how that society has unfolded, but, like, this is not a world where you're going to clear the burning fields and the city is going to unfurl before you, shining against the night.
Right.
This is a, this is a near, like, apocalypse adjacent world. And I think that's an interesting difference here as well, is that like there's an ugliness to this to the world of Blade Runner 2049 that the original movie, I think, shied away from. It left implied.
Right, right. You knew that under the glitz of the neon lights and the snake dancing and the glowing monitors and the fake animals, like, okay, yeah, it's a fake animal. That means that there's no real animals. Okay, that's dark. Here, like, you get a little bit more. You get a little bit more of the grime. You know, you get children enslaved. You get, and being sold, right? Like, you get a little bit more. And their space is cramped, and you see them working. They're not just implied to be working. There's a lot of those moments, I think, right? For better and worse. I don't want to just do, like, a hit-by-hit, you know, a punch-by-punch breakdown here. So it's like, Danielle, what's one of the big things, like the big takeaways for you? What are one of the topics that you're eager to talk about?
Yeah. So I have two major, major topics, and I'll start with the first one, which is the longer I've been since seeing it, and I do want to see it again. And I generally am very positive on this movie mm-hmm. with some reservations, kind of the way I was with the original. The number one thing is a parallel I see with actually the Star Wars movie from like 2 years ago, The Force Awakens, mm-hmm. where it collapses a little bit under the weight of both expectations and being an homage to an original piece. I think that this is a stronger movie overall, and I think Force Awakens is a perfectly fine movie. I don't think it's like a piece of crap or something. But that movie for me definitely would have been stronger if it held completely on its own, and I think that's true here as well. I think there gotcha. Are... I think that Harrison Ford is actually kind of a dead weight around this movie's neck in a lot of ways. I think that it went way too far into the whole Deckard thing and the whole, Rachel thing. And
I
understand it needed a MacGuffin. It needed a mystery. It needed something for, you know, Officer K to kind of do as he's going about his business and, you know, trying to figure out if he's a real boy or not. But I don't think it works all that well. I think it does weigh the movie down. And I think it weighs the movie down in a way that there are a lot of interesting things that are hinted at here. I think there is a very interesting movie that goes into android sexuality and mm-hmm. everything. That's the other topic I want to talk about, but I won't bring that up too much. I'm just bringing it up to say that I don't think it was done any kind of justice, because to serve the rest of this movie, to serve Harrison Ford, to serve the whole, like, oh, let's answer the questions of the first movie, but not really, to kind of go down that path, it ignored a lot of the genuinely fascinating questions, new questions.
The new
that
stuff, it yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
One thing I will say is one of the responses that I saw that kind of builds off of this from people was to say that they thought the mystery of the first film was more interesting than the questions asked in the second one, and I could not disagree more. You know, the key question of the first film for a lot of people, the key takeaway is, it begins with, is Deckard a replicant, you know, mm-hmm. especially in the director's cut and the final cut. And then from that, what does that then say about, you know, human life, human value? And even if he isn't one, then, like, what does Roy Batty, what do Pris, what are these characters who are replicants and who seem to have a full range of emotions, in fact, an enhanced range of emotions, what does it say about what we think counts as human? And I think that's a perfectly good question. But I think it's also a question that we've been asking ourselves for a long, 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 like well before Blade Runner. Blade Runner is a great film, but like, you know, people have been writing stories with automatons that take on human characteristics for a long time and have been digging into that, the notion of like who counts and who doesn't. It's a nice metaphor for marginalized people, for the disenfranchised. It's been around. What the new film asks often is, where do we generate value from? What is the arbiter of what counts more generally? Not just is synthetic life valuable, but is subjective value as valuable as what is presented to us as objective value? Which ends up being a very complicated question that I think the film does a good job of answering. But I think you're right to some degree that I think that the Deckard stuff complicates that by being an appeal to things we think we already know. So like when Rachel shows up, when the new model of Rachel shows up and Deckard says, oh no, the real one has green eyes. or I believe green eyes.
Yeah.
I think it's like a perfectly fine one-liner. I think Harrison Ford delivers all of his shit really well in this movie. I enjoyed seeing him work with Gosling, especially when they first meet. But I think it almost misses the larger point of the film, which is like the fact that she's different than the original model should not undercut the possibility that she could produce value for Deckard, that she could be a person who he loves, even if she doesn't biologically match this original being. Because so much of what's interesting to me about this film is like characters like Joy, character who is the sort of partner of Officer K, of Joe. She renames him Joe. And the importance of their relationship being that, like, it doesn't matter that she is a hologram. It doesn't matter that the beginning of that relationship was a commercial one, was that he bought this program who became Joy. What's important is that their relationship was genuine and had subjective value. Carolyn Pettit has written about this really well over on Feminist Frequency. She has an article called Officer K and the Real Girl, Cultural Dehumanization in Blade Runner 2049, and writes about how Joy being an active participant in her love of K is this really great kind of decoupling of biological femininity and feminine identity. It kind of rejects the entire notion of the kind of pregnancy subplot, which is all tied into the Deckard stuff you're talking about. And like, I think that stuff is a little bit cleaner if you do step away from the Deckard stuff. But also, I like that fight scene a lot of them in the Vegas like restaurant. Well, and so I kind of wish that we could rehabilitate those scenes instead of cut them completely.
I actually think we can, but I think it almost like is better if you discuss it as an act of the movie about like what the ultimate fate of Vegas has to say and how these two characters interact. That's a great scene. What bugs me, but I do think. The thing that really bothers me about the making Deckard and Rachel's love ? Making that so central to the film, which actually, you know, I'm being facetious there, but the movie definitely is like, they were the fated couple and all that. And like, just watch that movie. Their coupling is super troubling for a shit ton of reasons.
One, it completely sucks. But then I will say that the movie does also bring it, does have that little alibi in it. 2049 does have that bit where it's like, maybe Tyrell programmed you both so that you would meet each other and partner up.
This is where, so Danielle and I talked a lot about Blade Runner like on Idle Weekend a few weeks ago. And I think we sort of came around to like our like reading of the film is that basically a lot of what we're seeing is a science experiment. Like, there's no reason for him to meet Rachel at all, except Tyrell wants that meeting to happen. Yeah. Like, this is all this is all being sort of run behind the curtain by Tyrell to some extent. But what bugs me here is it starts from that place. But then what it ends up introducing is a freaking Chosen One narrative.
Yeah.
Right.
And the thing animating the replicant android resistance is this idea that, at least the way it kind of reads to me, that there's some sort of like replicant royal fucking family out there.
Right.
That they are rallying behind.
So this is the thing that so yes, I think you're totally right. That is what is happening. That the replicant resistance is like, yes, you know, King Deckard and Queen Rachel and the chosen heir. And the thing that I want there to be, and I need to see the movie again and again and again to start working through this, is they're wrong. And it's an echo of how the first replicant resistance was wrong. So in between Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049, they released these three prequel films that connect the two stories. Did you watch those?
No.
Okay, so the first one is the Batista character.
I've seen this one.
And him fleeing after trying to save a family, basically, in the LA streets.
Yeah.
The second one is Niander Wallace convincing or killing, I don't remember exactly, the board who decides whether or not you can make replicants. And he's like, you know what I've done for the world. I brought food back to the world. I fed everybody. You have to give me this extra kind of flexibility with the law. And they're like, no, the last time that we had replicants, like, they rebelled, and that's when the blackout happened. And he's like, yeah, but mine don't say no. Like, mine are complete slaves. And this is, that's with Leto, Jared Leto, and stuff.
Just a quick aside there. Something we left out about that first scene.
Yes.
Kay even makes it a point of pride.
Yes.
In his conversation with the Bautista character, he says, my kind or my model doesn't run.
Doesn't run. Exactly. Yeah. It's like, it is. It's a point of pride. It's definitely that. And the third one is an anime short film done by Shinichiro, or directed by Shinichiro Watanabe, the director of Cowboy Bebop, which means you should just see it already, especially since the final shot of Blade Runner is just the final shot of Cowboy Bebop. Blade Runner 2049 is literally the final shot of Cowboy Bebop. It is the backstory of the replicants doing the revolution, like 30 years ago. It is them causing the blackout, detonating a nuke in low orbit that destroys all of the, that like erases the records and shuts down, you know, all of the technology and blah, blah, blah. And the reason that that's important is that, or for me, is what did they earn in their revolution? Eventually what they earned was low wage work, slurs written on their doors, and the ability to join the free market. They get to go buy luxury goods now. Yeah,
to buy robotic girlfriends, basically.
Yes, exactly.
But all in this weird company town model where it's like, oh, you're in this closed loop. You know, it's a really shitty, like, Pullman village.
Right. So it's like, yes, they are no... And also, the shift from being given, you know, 6 years of a life cycle to... and the freedom to resist, to you can live forever, but you can't say no, which is also kind of vague, because I think that's another question here, is whether or not these characters, these new replicants, are actually enslaved, or if ideology is just hard to overcome, which, again, we can get into. But so for me, the thing that then that you can build off of that is there hope that, oh, if we have a king and a queen, not literally, but, you know, figuratively, oh, if we can, if... Oh, the way humans work is that everything comes down to biology. It comes down to a woman's value is in her uterus, basically. Right. Then that's what they also believe, and they're still caught in the loop. And the reason that I think that that is meaningful is that in the end, Kay doesn't side with, like, value is about what's physical and what's not physical. He sees the advertisement for joy. He sees the crassest version of the woman he loves, right? Of, like, here is the product that they're selling me. And his response isn't nihilistic. It isn't cynical. It isn't like, and that means that my relationship with joy was meaningless. It's, oh, these feelings I have towards Deckard, even though he isn't my father, even though my relationship with him isn't biological, those are still real, and so I want to do the right thing by him, instead of, like, doing the right thing by the resistance and you know, letting him die and all that, you know? It's, I think, a deeply complicated relationship that I have not... I could talk to you next week and feel the opposite way, but I don't think it's cut and dry as the resistance wants to protect the notion of childbearing replicant women, and that means that they're, because they're the resistance, that is the moral lens of the film. I think that they are being deceived too, you know?
Yeah, I just wish the resistance had as much screen time as that it really needed to develop a complex point of view, honestly.
That felt like so they're going to spin it off as a TV show or an anime, frankly. Like, it
not
really
a good TV
like...
show. That felt like some Canadian sci-fi, like, shot of Vancouver, and they're all wearing track pants.
Yes!
Actually, I mean, this brings up the fact that we're wrong that there are only two Blade Runner shows, or two Blade Runner works. There is also Total Recall 2070, as I think the name of the show. Total Recall 2070, a science fiction show that literally does take place in the Blade Runner universe. Sort of, kind of. it's like a combination of the Total Recall universe and the Blade Runner universe.
Okay.
Oh, good.
There are replicants.
Is it just PK Dick, or is it the movies universes? Because that's a totally different.
It's a mix.
Okay.
Like so, Recall exists as a company, like the Total Recall company,
okay.
Recall, and they also there's also a non Tyrell replicant company, and it's a buddy cop show between like shitty not Deckard, like. 100% The lead character is named Ian Favre, and he is just like, no, sorry, the lead character's name, I'm wrong, the lead character's name is David Hume.
Oh.
Of course. And he is bad. He's played by a guy who's
partnered with Norton Anthology.
Basically, he's partnered with a robot named Ian Favre who has a terrible haircut, but it is totally, what if there was a Blade, a Canadian Blade Runner show. 100% it's worth watching because it's
yes.
terrible, but I actively love it. Like, I really, I might do a second watch of,
quick
of
aside,
Total Recall 2070. Go ahead.
Who here watched the short-lived Fox detective show set in the Minority Report universe?
I watched the first two episodes of it and then couldn't anymore because they didn't get the point of that story at all. That
yeah.
story is about not trusting, like, any sort of automated police force. And then that's the show is, like, we're auto cops.
Well, I actually... So, I think they sort of found their feet, because I think where
okay.
it takes off is, like... Yeah, but the precogs still have their powers. Like, the society has decided that was a disastrous experiment, except one of the precogs is still seeing murders that actually happen. And so it's kind of this crisis of, like, how do I use this power without falling into the... shit the precog program did.
Yeah, I'm always cautious because that's like the weird devil's advocate argument though, right? Of like,
yeah.
I'm just a race realist. What if the science is right?
Oh, God!
What if the science is right? People don't want to believe, what if the science is right? And it's like, I still think maybe precogs don't listen. We can't arrest people before, we can't. What I was going to bring up is the other canceled Fox TV show.
Almost Human, yes.
which is good as far as I'm concerned.
It is.
It's legitimately good.
I'm adding these to my very long list.
Danielle, please.
Oh, these
watch
are so
Almost
good.
Human.
I know I'm going to need to watch this.
They're rough in all the right ways.
Yes,
like they misfire in ways that are like super endearing.
Yep, Michael Ealy and who's the white dude? Who's the white cop?
Guy who plays Bones.
Carl Urban.
Yes.
Oh. Carl Urban is the other cop
the guy.
In that. And that's a show that takes place in Detroit. It's the Detroit Become Human game. Like 100%.
Oh my god. If I were confident that Detroit Become Human were going to be half as good as Almost Human, I'd be on cloud nine. I'd just be like on a beach just like
yep.
waiting for this game.
This one isn't that old.
100%.
Okay.
No, this is 2014.
Yeah.
I really liked Almost Human a lot. It's bad. Like, it has some really rough episodes.
Sure.
Like, truly rough episodes.
I'm a Star Trek Voyager fan, so...
Yeah, you're ready to
don't
go.
Don't worry.
It's only 13 episodes. You'll blow right through it.
Hell yeah.
Now that we've talked about the extended Blade Runner universe, but you're totally right. Like, I think that sequence, the Resistance sequence, did feel like it needed more. But to me, it also just felt like... It was never going to be. This is never going to be the story of how the replicants overcame capitalism, because I think that I do think that the film is about getting yours, and I don't mean
mm-hmm.
that in a cynical
mm-hmm.
sense. In the like getting yours, where like you get yours and then disconnect from the rest of the world, you get paid. It's not about getting paid. It's about finding value in a place you can't change.
It's about getting your human rights.
No, it's
bit.
Not about
well,
getting human rights. It's not. It's
no?
there isn't. I don't know, because then it would be about the resistance, and then it would be like, how do they go about getting? How do they fight back against the laws? And
see,
how do they actually change?
Watch that. That's the
I know, but I'm saying
I
that's not
see.
What this.
Yeah.
But like, I think that those movies, those stories do exist about androids. Those stories do exist about the. And I'm saying this is like, I think one of my biggest problems with the film is there are three or four characters of color in a film that's very clearly about. Like being
yeah.
a person of color who is mistreated and has slurs tossed at you, and you're a working, you have to work the jobs that nobody else wants to
also,
work.
Also,
that's even
being a
slave
style
hunter
in the background of a scene.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, he's
God
a doctor.
Damn it! I got
that's
so excited 100%. For a split second.
Yep.
He was one of the other cops, right? Like
yes,
he was.
He's like the coroner or something.
I was like, please let him be the partner.
And then there's another famous actor, the guy who
Ryan the Orphanage.
No, him too. But then also the one who I'm thinking of is the one who recognized what type of bug it was or whatever.
Oh, the dude from the Somalian actor.
The Somalian actor, yeah. Yeah, or yes, I don't actually know if he was Somalian, but he was in...
No, he is.
Okay, yes.
Yeah.
From Captain Phillips, right? Is that the name of the...
And, like, walked away with that picture, like...
Oh, yeah, totally, 100%. The fact that I can't name him is a depressing thing. Barkhad Abdi. I'm pretty sure that was him. It was him in Blade Runner also. So it's like there are no characters of color in this movie that is about an entire race of people being forced to do the dirt for white people.
Okay,
for
so this
rich
is
white people.
Something I actually wanted to get into because we talked a little bit about it on Idle Weekend when we were talking about Blade Runner.
Yeah.
So, like, I definitely think it's definitely problematic that there's like these omissions and these roles aren't written in this movie. But my question is the movie making a point about the racism of its society, or is the movie just like playing into like latent racism?
I think it's both, right? Yeah. I think that you can have the person who intends that, but then also here's the actual way in which it's making a commentary that I think is unintentional is there is no black Ryan Gosling in Hollywood. There should be. There absolutely should be. And the way to make that is to cast that role, you know? But like, or maybe there is. Like, maybe it's Chadwick Boseman, right? You know, like maybe a year from now, there will be no excuse. I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah, I'm not sure that you'd get a star of color who's allowed to have as little affect as Gosling does in a lot of his roles.
That's exactly what I mean. Like, that's part of the appeal of Gosling is that when he's in that mode, when he's in his drive mode instead of his nice guys mode, he is, like, terrifying. And when black men are terrifying on screen, they're rarely allowed to be both terrifying and sexy. And Gosling's that's one entire part of one of his modes is I am both terrifying and sexy. Black men don't get that. Black women or women of color in general just like don't get access to roles, period. I don't know. There's lots of roles that could have been played by people of color. There's a way to tell this story that I think better, you know, centralizes women as protagonist roles instead of just kind of
other
adjacent
than sex workers and or
yeah I need to I
holographic
really,
housewives
yeah I'm so
Robin
torn on that.
Wright,
I'm curious
who's
what you
alive for a few
that's
minutes.
true I'd forgotten on. Of course
actually Robin Wright I think does a lot with a limited role, but I think her character the lieutenant ends up having a really interesting arc and some nuanced interactions with Kay that, like, mm-hmm. she's one of those great characters where she leaves me with a lot of questions about who she is when she leaves the picture. Like, she's not a solved problem for me.
Not at all.
What did you make of that? Because you brought her up, Danielle. Like, is there anything that leaped out there?
Yeah, I mean, this is a classic case for me of actors and actresses who are 1,000 times more interesting and talented than the top billed talent. Like, I would have rather seen this movie if it was Robin Wright as an android trying to figure out her own shit. Like, frankly, I mean, that's just for me.
Yeah.
We also have, like, Edward James Olmos in this movie, and, like...
But he was not reprising his role of Gaff. Like, that was Edward James Olmos is in this movie, just
that
to, like, show that,
a check,
like...
100%. Oh, I know, but I feel the same way about Harrison Ford, honestly, in this movie. Like,
I like him more in it. I think that he's, like, I just think that he has good rapport with Gosling. I also have a big crush on Gosling, so I'm gonna be fine, like, I'm gonna want to see, like, Gosling be that dude on screen. I just am.
I kind of want both of them to just drown in the fucking sea and then the more interesting people to do other stuff.
Yeah,
but, you know,
so well, the thing is,
go ahead.
I think the thing that I like about the lieutenant as a character is that she very clearly encapsulates the like emptiness of the people who say you're one of the good ones. or the not the emptiness, but the ulterior motive there. Like, she fetishizes Kay for a lot of reasons, right? Like, she very much likes to be in control of him. The sequences where she is testing exactly how enslaved he is to her are very frightening, and also have this, like, it was weird, because that's a sequence that, if that is and I think in a number of other films, that would be a sequence that was played to be almost exploitatively scary between a male lieutenant and a female android, mm-hmm. That role is meant to kind of play with that. And I think that, Villeneuve, that's not how you pronounce it, is I never get his name right.
Villeneuve. I don't know.
It's Villeneuve. Is trying to play with gender in this movie, and I don't know that it always works at all. I think a lot of women have correctly pointed out that it doesn't, even though there are characters like the lieutenant, like the leader of the resistance, who is a woman, it rarely feels like Love, the assassin replicant, who is like diehard, not only diehard enslaved, but like is, you know, her closing line is, I'm the best one. Even though there are those characters who take action, it's rare that their perspective feels agentic. It feels like it is the perspective the film cares about. Though I do think that I'm so curious what to make of the love scene, which is, and I've seen sex workers write about this now or talk about this on Twitter, is a very rare instance of, I think, one, women engage, like women in film, in big blockbuster Hollywood film, being the people who decide that sex work should happen, and then seeing that sex work as a thing that is intended, at least, to be a positive interaction and not dirty and not gross. I'm curious if either of you walked away from that sequence with any feelings.
A lot of feelings. Every feeling that exists.
Yeah.
So I kind of want to go about this slightly differently, in that I have been interested in a lot of people's different reactions, not just to the sure. scene, but to the how gender is presented in general in this movie. Because I think that's the biggest flaw of the movie. I think it really fucks up when it comes to gender. I think it wants to say some things. I think it raises some interesting questions. And I think it pukes all over itself when it comes to actually executing on saying something interesting about it. So there's obviously Carolyn's piece is wonderful, and she goes into this a tiny bit about, she says in her piece, Joy is a troubling figure in the film, a commodified embodiment of a male fantasy, which the film never examines closely or critically enough, and she deserves a piece all her own. So that's just her little aside there about that. And I agree with that completely. I think there's something interesting there. There's something interesting about Joy. There's something interesting about a person who is really a product, who is developed in a certain way, and she's programmed to want to make a man happy in every way. Mm-hmm. And the film uses all these 50s housewife ass, you know, kinds of things.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's really like, oh, honey, you're home.
Let me make you dinner.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
and then
totally.
Just how interchangeably she can look like something else. And of course, it's all different, you know, very hegemonic ideals of the way women are supposed to look. This is what a hot woman looks like. So the movie is presenting this and showing us these images in a way that I think we're supposed to be somewhat critical of. But then we're also supposed to accept that, no, she's a real person too, and she really loves him. She just happens to be, you know, only existing to love him because he bought her.
Well, no, I don't think that's true at all. See, my whole read on this film is that these characters are not, in fact, enslaved at all. Like, that, the only way this movie makes sense to me is if none of these characters, that the programming has intense limits. Like, it just doesn't read unless Kay can do whatever he wants, because he constantly does whatever he wants. If Joy can do whatever she wants, like, she doesn't have the Asimovian rules of self-preservation. Like, she makes the very clear choice, and I'm 100% with you that I think it's shitty that the choice that she makes is like, no, I love you, the male figure in this movie.
Right.
That's how I'm proving that I'm a real person. But I think that that's a choice that comes from her. I don't think I don't know that the movie makes sense to me if the characters who were told are perfectly enslaved are perfectly enslaved.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily about enslavement. I think it's more that, honestly, I think the movie just didn't do enough work to show me that she is actually a real person who has real feelings. Like, that's my issue here.
For me, that sex scene is that scene, which is like, he clearly is kind of awkward about it, and she's the one who wants it.
She's trying to please him. Like, I completely read that as
super weird.
Yeah, like, he's saying it's weird, body but she's like, no, I have to be real to make you happy. Like, it's a complete self-sacrifice. Yeah. She doesn't seem like she's pleasurably into it. I would get that absolutely if she was looking up and down Mackenzie Davis like, yeah, all right, let's do this.
No, but I think she's looking up and down Kay like that. Like, that's the character that she's into in that sequence, right? Like, I don't know. Like, I think that I'm totally willing to defer to your read here. But, like, I seeing that, it felt to me like he didn't want to. He was the one who was the least interested in being in that scene.
So, can I throw out a slightly different reading that like totally might split the difference a little bit?
Sure.
For me, the thing that I think Joy is able to make, like, these are the things that, like, she wants, but the question is, does she have a choice in what she chooses to want? You know,
right,
what I mean?
Totally.
Like, and for me, that's kind of the meaning of that scene where he sees the giant ad and she's, you know, this really tacky sex object.
Yep.
In this ad. And I think it is a moment where we're meant to reflect on, like, how genuine could that relationship have ever been if the place she starts from is what Danielle's talking about, which is she exists for you.
Right.
And, like, she's such a great she's such a great product that she is the slave that never contemplates freedom. Or the concept would have no meaning. Because just what they organically want,
fruit from the poison tree type situation.
Yeah, and so I think, like, it makes their relationship really interesting because I think it does feel like she has this agency, and she does, like, make some really self-sacrificing choices that, like, are her own. Like, she's afraid to risk death, but she does it because she loves this guy. But toward the end of the movie, he's also forced to contemplate, like, where she came from and how she was used up until these last few days.
Yeah, and I think, you know, to its weakness, that is a mirror for his own. Where did I come from? Am I also just this? Like, I think that is, she is not fridged, because I think that she's given lots of time, like, in the traditional sense, which is like, oh, a woman is killed in the first 15 minutes of a movie to justify a shitty revenge plot. But she is killed in order for him to confront his own lack of agency, or to wonder, is my own agency mine? Am I also programmed to be doing the things I'm doing right now? And I like, I'm 100% with you that I want more of her by herself. I am curious, like, what does she do all day besides, like, does she do things that are not, here's what I'll do when he gets home? Because my, like, non-cynical take is yes, but that's in my imagination and not on the film, right?
I don't know. He literally turns her off at one point when he has to go to work. Like, I don't
know,
man.
True.
But
true.
I'm curious how you guys, what you guys made of a moment toward the end of the sex scene or that entire sequence. There's a really mutually nasty moment between Joy and Mackenzie Davis's character.
Yeah.
That sat weirdly with me. I don't know that it's a bad choice from a writing standpoint, but it is an example of, it's kind of like, you know, the matron and the whore, or, you know, the wife and the prostitute, basically, like, sniping each other for the roles they fill. Mm-hmm. And it does. And I don't know how I felt about it, because basically both of them are, like, really nasty and denigrating of each other, over their, like, mutual jealousy of their status, both in, like, in this social hierarchy and also in their relationship to this person. So I'm just curious what you guys made of that.
Yeah, I thought it was shitty and damning in terms of this movie wanting to go for the cheap fucking laugh instead of actually have a meaningful thing to say about gender and sexuality. And
I was bummed
and not, is there a term for this? Not embodied sexuality, like sexuality that completely exists within, for example,
right,
an AI and a being that exists in the physical world. I don't know.
Right. I'm not sure. I am curious if, or the thing that bummed me out, but it felt cheap when she shows back up and, oh, she's secretly been part of the resistance the whole time, because for me, like I said, I have a pretty positive read on that sex scene, in that I think it is a rare scene in science fiction, especially in Blade Runner, right? Which, like, sex workers in that first film literally exist to be killed. And in this case, it felt like I could imagine why, like, I saw that sequence as being pro-sex work, as being like, hey, this is a thing that someone in a relationship wants as part of their relationship, and that is not the depiction we would have gotten in the original Blade Runner, right? Like, Deckard would have dismissed any sex worker as being fake or as being, like, unnecessary or dirty, and, like, that was not what happened in that part of it, in the actual love scene. And then as soon as it was over, that's exactly what happened when she was like, I'm done with you, which fucking sucked. And then, like, undercut her value as a person who did sex work by then later saying, oh, the reason she's valuable is because she's part of the resistance, not because she, like, brings joy into people's lives consensually, which would have been fine. Like, she didn't need to also be part of the resistance in order for her to be a valuable person, which undercuts to me the larger message, the thing that I'm taking away, which is about subjective value, which is a bummer. Like, I absolutely think that part, like, is totally a missed mark.
I think there's really kind of one... I think the lieutenant is somewhat interesting. I think there's really kind of one woman character in this movie that is not an absolute just missed opportunity to do something interesting. And that is, it's Dr. Stalene, I think is her name. And she is the woman who makes robot memories out of a sort of a beautiful, weird, interesting little machine.
I'm the other
machine.
Way on her. Really? She bums me out. She, to me, was like the biggest missed mark on women characters in this, because she's... We'll talk. You go ahead. Why does she work for you?
Well, she works for me because it's a woman who is, in the most literal sense, she's in a cage. She's in, like, a glass cage, basically, right?
Mm-hmm.
She has no real contact with the rest of the world. She has no real contact with the rest of the ugliness in the world. And she actually manages to make beautiful things. Like, she's kind of the one person in this world who makes something beautiful and who makes something... that doesn't feel like, I don't know, like a gendered product, like a very, like...
I mean, so for me, it was she does the reproductive labor of keeping every replicant, like, working. She's the one who builds their memories so that they feel like people and can work for free for other people. She's like, they've mass marketed... Like, if Joy is literally a mass market wife that dudes can go to buy, then for every replicant, they have the Dr. Stalene who, like, does the reproductive labor of creating a childhood for them. She's every replicant's mother. And that is, like, and then is kept behind a cage and then is, like, positioned as the MacGuffin for Deckard. And, like, that was, like, oh, like, I wish Deckard had found a way towards... subjective value the way that Kay does, like, had found a way to be like, I lived my life, I know I loved Rachel, whether or not I was programmed for it or not, like, whatever, I'm glad we got the fuck out of that town. I don't need to, the my only connection, the only thing in my life that's valuable is not the daughter that I had who has been locked away. Like, I'm glad that they reconnect, like, in a very traditional storybook way. Like, I'm also glad we don't see them reconnect. I'm glad that we don't, like, there's not a big, like, tearful reunion, because I don't think that that's, like you said earlier, Daniel, like, not the focus of the story. But
also,
that was
ain't nobody having a warm reunion with late career Harrison Ford.
No, definitely not. I couldn't imagine. I wonder if they shot that and it was just like, this is too, no, just, no, like, no, you're not, you don't care about this, Harrison.
Just turn the camera off and yell cut in a few minutes. I'm gonna go get a coffee.
Yeah. You get to fly your plane in like 10 minutes, Harrison. Just pretend you're flying your plane.
Please don't crash it this time.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Seriously. I just think the biggest bummer for me in the movie, and it was a bummer for me, was that I do feel like it really was trying to bring up some questions. I do feel like it was trying to do something with Joy, but I really don't think it did enough with that character. And I don't think it condemned. What I felt like it was trying to have its cake and eat it too, in terms of being like, look at this objectification. Look at how gross this is. Look at how weird it is to commodify women to this degree. But also it totally did that. It totally did that by showing hot pictures of sexy girls. Yeah. Like, it's absolutely,
I mean, like I said,
one of those
the same,
for me.
It is like, that plus further on, not further, it's not Olympics, right? But like, there are three people of color in that
absolutely
movie. Can't name any of them. But it's a story about black and brown bodies being used to hurt other black and brown bodies. So like, I get it 100%. It is also to me, like, here's the actual thing is, like, I think if I lean into that reading of the film, then it is the most depressing film we've seen, right? Like, it's such a cynical reading to read, like, joy as having no agency, that I don't know that I can confront it. And that is on me as a viewer, right? Like, I want joy to be, I want the, you know what it is? It's like, it's the end of the Carolyn piece. The Carolyn piece over at Femme Freak is like, after losing his joy, Kane encounters an interactive ad for the Joy product line, but he seems to know that the connection he had with his particular joy cannot be replaced. So Kay himself, now aware of his own existence as an individual, can't go back to being an obedient replicant who accepts his own status as subhuman and serves as an institution that violently enforces the baseless imposed hierarchy. Maybe he finally understands that every replicant, including himself, is real, even if they don't meet the culture's artificial oppressive standards for what constitutes real. And so, like, that is the lens that I think about the relationship with Joy. And Joy as an individual who is herself not just an obedient AI, but is and you know, a real, even though she doesn't meet society's overarching, including the people who should be Joy's allies, the replicants, who even they think what real is biological birth, right? Is, oh, the only thing that is real is Rachel had a baby, and that's why we're real. The only reading for me that doesn't make me hurt is the one that says the biological necessity, the shackles that are put on us by capitalism, all of those shake in the face of our decision to make for us our own values that then we can go fight for. And the thing that falls apart is the thing that you've pointed out, which is for each of the female characters in the movie, the thing that they value is some dude. In the case of Joy, it's Kay or Joe. In the case of Love, it's Neander. And then, like, we don't really get anything for... I guess, like, Lieutenant is just kind of, like, fuck off to Love when their encounter happens.
I don't know that Love gives a shit about Neander.
She wants to be the best one, and the person who judges that is Neander. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
But she operates pretty independently. Like,
totally.
She openly refers to she's going to lie to him.
That's fair, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
The thing about her character is, like, she definitely comes across as the, well, you know, it's not about a movie, like, this to do with slavery. She's sort of playing the character that...
like the house character.
In Django.
Yeah,
the Samuel Jackson. Jackson character.
She's the Uncle Tom. Yeah, absolutely. I'll say it.
Well, except more malevolent, I think, right? Like, the issue there is, like, this is a character who's found a tremendous amount of power by sort of wearing a mask of obedient servant to a really powerful and amoral master.
Right.
And uses that to basically give themselves the green light to a lot of their own abuses. Perpetrated against people like themselves. And I kind of felt that, like, Love is definitely operating in that space. But I don't know.
It protects the status quo because she happens to be one of the few who benefits from it.
Yeah, and she has to believe she's the best, because otherwise, why does she deserve to have this privileged life when her fellows are... you know, being kept in slums or bombed from orbit, basically.
Right. By her, bombed from orbit. Yeah.
So I don't know. I think Love is a character that came away. I was pretty intrigued by as well. I want to talk a little bit about. So we talked about assigning value and the limits of, like, political imagination and revolution. For me, one of the things that, like, the whole movie kind of, like, it's weird. The movie underplays it, but my memory of it, the whole sequence looms pretty large. When he goes out to the junkyard.
Yeah.
Out in what used to be San Diego, which is a pretty vicious dig at San Diego from Hollywood.
Yeah.
Goes out to the San Diego junkyard, and you discover, like, how the other half live. where not only like the underclass that we've seen in like Los Angeles is at least like still a part of that society, right? Like you're you know, they're low status, but they're at least part of it. The thing we see in San Diego is all the unsightly, exploitative, nightmarish shit that enable that society that we spent our whole movie, the whole movie watching, the whole movie in. And San Diego is actually where a lot of it is made possible. It is where stuff is recycled. Right. It is where stuff is turned usable again. It is where, it is where children and like replicant children are kind of dumped to learn
e-waste work, basically.
Yeah. And nobody's political imagination or vocabulary even encompasses these people's existence.
Right. And they are the subaltern who, like, cannot even, there is no revolution for the children, right? There is no resistance. The resistance leaders don't go, and then we're going to go to San Diego and free those kids.
No.
Yeah.
And so, that entire sequence ended up looming pretty large for me because it's like, let's see, it's a free fire zone. Like, you want to... Does a corporation want to drop cluster munitions into San Diego because one of their company representatives is being like getting jacked?
Yeah.
Sure, they can do that. Do you just want to dump like acres of refuse on their heads and make children sift through it? Absolutely fine. It is kind of this giant open air gulag.
Right.
And it's
clear that this is not a thing that's happening in the ignorance of those who could do something about it. It is explicitly the powerful and the rich who go to buy wares there.
Yeah, including the implication seems to be if you're lucky enough, one of those little children.
Lucky is strong, Rob.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. Does Kay have it better than somebody who's stripping capacitors off circuit boards like out of a junk heap 24/7?
Right.
Probably a little bit. But this is the thing, right? Like, yes, lucky is relative. But the thing is, like, this is like the underclass, and nobody's acknowledging that it exists. And this is one of the things I like about this setting. So we've now hit the stage of the history of this universe where the off-world colonies are pretty much, it sounds like, almost self-sufficient. Like, they're kind of...
8 of them, and they work. Yeah.
Yeah. And things, at least according to what we hear, are roughly proceeding, like, a pace there, right? Like, it's not a total, like, nightmare catastrophe out in the off-world colonies.
Right, the thing that Wallace says is he wants... 8 isn't enough. 16 isn't enough. He wants a million, right? Like, that's the thing.
Yeah.
He is like classic venture capitalist. He wants to see hockey stick growth. He doesn't want to
just
see
wants
regular
to disrupt,
growth.
You know, yeah, colony exactly. growth, all right? He just wants to disrupt it.
He just loves 4Xs.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. He absolutely, you know, say what you will about Jared Leto, but dude nailed that character. The piece of shit Silicon Valley wannabe god. I mean, like, even more so than Tyrell, I think, in the first film, who was just soulless corporate piece of crap. Like,
yeah, I feel like Tyrell, like, reflects the difference between Tyrell and Wallace, reflects the difference between what we think of as tech leaders. Exactly,
yeah,
totally, right?
I think that's fair. I suppose it's just that I'm a more aware human being of 2017, and I know more of the bad things here than I clearly did in 1980. Well, I wasn't around.
No, I just think
in 1982, obviously, but yeah.
You're totally right, is all. I think that, like, the Tyrell version of it is just the tech bros didn't get there. It weren't as Silicon Valley-y as they are, right?
Yeah, like a Wall Street dick. Like,
actually, hold on, though. Actually, I think a crucial difference is Tyrell is portrayed as sort of the founder of the company. He's the genius who made a lot of this possible. Like, he can build replicants. Like, he basically imbued these replicants with, like, you know, the breath of life, basically. Like, he knows the tech, he knows the science, and he feels entitled to be, like, their god. But he, like, built that corporation. Wallace collected distressed assets. And
listen, he fed everybody. He figured out how to grow maggots that we could eat, and then he bought all the distressed assets.
Right, but this is what I mean: is that I think for a lot of reasons, Danielle, he actually reads as Hollower because he is a TED Talk thought leader.
Oh, yeah.
Whose vision and understanding of the replicants is complete bullshit in a way that Tyrell's was not. But in 2017, we are so hyper-aware of this character. There was room in the 80s to sort of still kind of admire or appreciate a Tyrell character for all their sins.
Yeah.
But, like, a Wallace character is just, you know, an exploitative phony.
You've seen the this is like the again the nerdiest shit, and that it's about weird crossover stuff. But you've seen the Peter Weyland.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
About Tyrell.
Better than Prometheus by far.
Well, that's another discussion. I think Prometheus actually has a lot of really interesting stuff as well.
Yeah, I don't want to throw
Prometheus
team...
under the bus. Is all I'm saying. It can get thrown under.
You don't
like want to
throw it under the giant wheel.
A scooter, like a small scooter. Yeah.
For people who don't know what we're talking about, though, briefly, there was something that came out of Prometheus that was like a letter or something that specifically mentioned a. Yeah, it's a letter, it's a thing inside of the, like, on a screen somewhere that includes, like, a whole line about making replicants and how, I mean, it's very clear, it's like, that's how he ran his corporation, like a god on top of a pyramid overlooking a city of angels. Like, of course he chose to replicate the power of creation in an unoriginal way by simply copying God versus you know, Weyland having built androids, specifically like actually robotic beings instead of just kind of genetic clones. Which actually, I am actually, here's another step. Let's go back to a thing that Danielle mentioned forever ago, which was production design. But let's kind of blow that up a little bit, because the thing I really want to talk about, I think the production design in this movie is okay. I think there are highs and lows. I think that there's like, I think that the fly through Vegas that I think is a model. Is really great.
Yes.
I don't think that Kay's gun is very good compared to the original Deckard gun, but what can be? But the thing I actually want to talk about is the new Voight Kampff test, the baseline test.
Mm, yes.
In which you repeat lines from, or at least Kay repeats lines from Pale Fire, the Nabokov poem. What did you think of that sequence?
This was one example.
Or those sequences,
This was one example for me where... It's so clear that they're trying to do an homage to a previous thing, and it's so clear that they want it to have its own personality, its own flavor. They want it to be this more minimalist thing, whereas, you know, sort of chunky analog technology was cool in 1982. Now it's like this, it's clean, really nice
looking.
Right,
that room. Yeah.
In the room and everything. I think it looked cool. I understand the purpose that it served, but I do think this was one of those examples where it was like... It was trying a little too hard to be what Blade Runner was. And it was one of those examples where it kind of fell apart a little bit for me.
Rob, what about you?
I loved it. okay, so the things I liked about it. The new Voight Kampff test done off your smartphone fucking sucks. Don't like that at all. Like, give me the giant eye reader. God damn it. I want to see like a giant like 1080 retina. Just like reacting to creepy stories. But the baseline test, I liked it because it underscored what you've talked about, Austin, are any of these people really enslaved at all?
Right.
Like, all it is, yeah, it's partly a voice stress test, right? Like, response time and voice stress. Like, how are you responding to these snatches of text and word association? They're all ritualistic, but sort of circle around themes of servility and obedience. And the test itself is a very, like, rapid-fire, gun to your head, Simon Says. But the other thing I like about it is it's so patently nonsense.
Right.
Like,
yes.
It is so obviously doing nothing, because even after the tests, even after the replicants come out, humans are still uneasy about them because they know this is nothing. They know that, you know, they know there's no man behind the curtain.
Security right. theater this is, kind of thing. Yeah.
Say again?
It's like a security theater kind of thing.
Yes, 100%. Yes, 100%. Like, and the thing that it actually reminded me of is when we had just recorded the first Wolfenstein 101 right before I went to go see this movie. And so I remembered Frau Engel's card test in the train, which is the same thing in that, like, well, it's the same thing, one, in that it's arbitrary, in that, like, at the end of the day, what it came down to is, does the lieutenant can the lieutenant step in and give him the go-ahead to go forward, even though he's quote-unquote off his baseline? It's always going to come down to what people in power want, not what the test says. The test is always going to be secondary to, like, whoever has a badge. Two, the thing that I really actually liked about it was that it, you know, the thing that I always say, people remember flying cars, they forget, you know, burning oil fields on fire. People remember from the Voight Kampff test the turtle on the back. They remember the you know, the questions about sexuality. Is this test about whether I'm a replicant or a lesbian, Mr. Deckard, right? Like, they, those are the things that they remember. But the actual Voight Kampff test, as written, is about, like, response. It's about physical... it's about physical
pupil
attributes.
Response.
It's,
yeah.
Pupil response, heart rate, blushing. It's not about what the answers are at all. You could say whatever you want to the Voight Kampff test. You could say, oh yeah, I step on the turtle, as long as the machine supposedly judges you as human, as like, oh, you blush the way a human blushes. and the thing I like about this is like how naked it is that. And it feels to me like the same thing that you pointed out, Danielle, between Tyrell and Wallace, that, like, this is the updated 2017 yeah. version. We don't fuck around with questions anymore. Just say the fucking word. Just pick up your phone and look at it. Does it recognize you? And, like, that was I like that was great. And then the second bit is just, like, I do think the rhythm of it, the, like, the machine gun rhythm of needing to replace or to repeat the final word of each line is like memorable and striking in a way that they would have, that I thought like was a surprise to me. Like I entered that scene being like, all right, here we go. And then still ended up really enjoying it.
Now that we're talking about it, I'm starting to appreciate it a little bit more. I'm not going to lie. You're making okay. a compelling case. You're both making a compelling case for it. As I watched it, I rolled my eyes a little bit. I'm not going to lie.
Right.
But,
The little bit of trivia here with it is that it was, and I think people will end up talking about this, and I bet you'll get comparisons to Roy Batt or to Rutger Hauer co-writing the kind of final speech at in the original Blade Runner. He did not improv it. People often say he improv'd it. He didn't improv
it. But he co-wrote it.
He co-wrote it. Yeah, he co-wrote it in the writer's room.
Well, shit.
Which is awesome. Yeah. Totally. But in this, the new Voight Kampff test, the new baseline test, Gosling wrote it. There was like a smaller version of the sequence, but then Gosling delivered, like, wrote an 8 minute version of that take or of that, and then delivered it, and like that's what they ended up going with, and like cut it down a little bit and reshot it and stuff. But it was Gosling who was like, "Oh no, this is what the baseline test should feel like." And I think that's interesting. I think that's like I don't always love it when you go like, oh, the star figured out the thing with the story, because it just like leans into the weird, like, oh, we're not going to talk about how good the cinematography is, but we're going to talk about how the actor whose name you know
one. Let's talk about how good the cinematography is, and more importantly,
please,
how cool the cinematographer is.
Please, let's talk about it.
So I saw it in IMAX, and you know, sometimes IMAX showings aren't necessarily like as good as they should be, because like sometimes it's just you're taking the 35 millimeter print of the film, or sorry, the 35 millimeter projection these days, since a lot of it's digital,
it's
but
digital,
yeah, and you're just sort of blowing it onto a bigger screen with different a lot of different variables, like there's so much to color reproduction and lighting reproduction that like it is a science, and I am not versed in it, but it does mean that a lot of like IMAX showings can be a little bit iffy. And I wasn't sure how I should see this movie until Austin shared me a link to the greatest forum on the internet.
So good. I need everyone real quick. Don't go to the forum. Let them have this. Please let them have this. Talk about the forum, Rob.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Well, now I feel guilty. Now I feel like this is the beach. I'm gonna be like, yo, you guys been to Roger Deakins forum?
Oh, man.
But no, like, so there's this thread on the cinematographer's website, Roger Deakins.
So Roger Deakins, who is a cinema. If you don't know Roger Deakins, Roger Deakins is a cinematographer who has done a lot of incredible work. He's worked with the Coen brothers a lot. He was the cinematographer on films. I mean, I guess the big recent one that he's done that people have probably seen was like Skyfall. He was a cinematographer on, and I think Skyfall has problems, but like it ain't those shots. Those shots look good as hell. But he was a cinematographer on like True Grit, on A Serious Man, which is one of my favorite movies, on Intolerable Cruelty, on The Man Who Wasn't There, which is also beautifully shot. A beautiful mind. Like, he's done a ton of stuff. He's a fantastic cinematographer and filmmaker. But then, yeah, he has this form. And what was the thread called?
It was basically like, what format should I see? And there were a lot of like, maybe by this forum standards, these were kind of the know-it-all characters, but like by general internet characters, like these people were great. Yeah. But it was people being like, oh, don't see it this way because like the HDR projection system in these theaters sucks and all this. And Deakins sort of like arrives in the middle of the conversation. He's like, actually, there's no bad way to see it, which is a company man thing to say, except he's like, no, let me explain to you the processes I went through for every format of the film that's out there. And the exact watchouts you have to be concerned about with those formats. So like how IMAX both distorts color reproduction and aspect ratio a little bit is an issue. Different theaters have different projection systems, which you need to account for because like the same image shot through one projector will look different through another. Deakins like corrected for all of that. And so whatever you're seeing is kind of the definitive cinematographer's vision of the film, quite literally.
For that format, basically.
Yeah. But the great thing about it is it's Roger Deakins just talking with people on the internet about film projection and going to the movies these days.
Unbelievable. It's unbelievable. He's just like it's like one of the greatest cinematographers of our time, and someone is like, hey, thanks for having this website. A friend and I are trying to complete a dark thriller movie and we need a little advice on how to build an opening scene on a guy who walks through an alley and enters a building. The atmosphere is tense, wind blowing, blah blah blah. And he's like, he responds. First of all, he's the only person who responds to this post. And then he goes, that's too much of an open question. I would study the natural light that hits the alley and decide from there. It may be the setting sun doesn't create much and you'd be better off lighting the shot, maybe at night. Impossible for somebody else to make that decision. And like, yo, you just got advice from Roger Deakins.
Yeah, like, just imagine being able to go up to like, Conrad Hall, like in a diner or something and be like, so
let
me,
unbelievable. Like, oh, what's your storyboarding approach? And then he like walks through what his storyboarding approach is. It's so cool to see a creator. And again, like part of this is the thing that we talked about earlier, which is like nobody knows who Roger Deakins is. Like of the 100% of people who went to go see Blade Runner 2049, 2% know who Roger Deakins is. And I'm counting me as the 4th percent, who's the person who's like, he did Sicario, right? He did that. Like I had to be like, oh wait, this is this guy? Holy shit. So I don't know. Like I was very charmed by him.
Yes, this is. I'm looking at it now. That is really something special.
It's neat. I wish we had more of this in gaming. Like I do wish that we had. Like, I mean, that's not true. We probably do have this in gaming. I don't know about it because I'm not going to forums for level designers.
But I think we almost had it in the Brainy Sphere, and then things got just the space changed.
Space changed for sure.
Honestly, I think one of the reasons this works is because the people who know about who Roger Deakins is generally aren't extremely online. And so it's this weird, like, internet island of a famous cinematographer's, like, blogspot page and, like, the half dozen people who've registered there to talk to him. It's really cool.
How about in honor of this, like, we talk about, we each have, like, one shot that we thought was really good in Blade Runner 2049. One piece of composition that we think really stood out. Does anyone have one that's like, boom, this is mine?
The entire Vegas sequence for me is a standout. But the shootout in the music hall, which... At first, I was like, this is a little too on the nose. This is a little bit much. It's all these holographic projections of the Elvis in his Vegas costume in his Vegas years. So it's all white suit, rhinestone Elvis. But the system is glitching. And so the lighting in the scene keeps, like, you are plunged repeatedly from, like, stark, like, blazing stage lights and, like, laser shows and, like, these, like, serried ranks of Elvises singing the hits to, like, pitch black, cannot see anything except, like, muzzle flashes.
Right.
In this... And by the way, you're all at a surprising distance from the action in this sequence. Like, you're taking in the whole room, but what's foregrounded is the empty dining tables arrayed around the stage, on which the actors are now players as well. Like, the characters are now sort of, we are watching from the gallery as this floor show takes place, both the glitched one and then the one unfolding between Ryan Gosling and Harrison Ford. But it is just such a dazzling and evocative moment. And it should be tacky and overdone and is right on that line, but it is carried off so well that, like, a shot that had me rolling my eyes at the start, by the end, like, had me on my feet.
Totally. Danielle, what about you? Does anything jump out?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's, like, 100 things. The first thing I'll just say is Rachel's tomb being the most obvious biblical thing ever, this sort of biblical reference. It's really interesting. The composition is, like, so stark. It's that super, super white and that sort of gauzy lighting, and then it's, like, the tree. Okay, but really also also in the Vegas sequence, it's I don't think it's one shot. There are a couple of long shots in there. There are a few cuts in there as well, but the sort of destroyed, decaying statues that were, you know, these, like, dazzling, beautiful, giant statues. It almost looks like...
But they're so tacky.
Oh, they're so tacky. Good. It's a James Bond intro sequence gone to die in a desert.
Oh my God, that's so good.
And
that's totally what it is.
It's so perfect. And it is so... This is Vegas. So I'm gonna go with that one.
My favorite thing about that whole sequence, too, is just, what happened to Vegas? We don't know. Like, I don't know. Like, a bomb, maybe? You know?
Like, well, it looks like some catastrophes happened to Vegas, and then a bomb
hit. Yes, yes. Wait, I have a question. Were there bees? Were there a sequence of bees? His hand gets covered with bees? Fucking so good. Ugh. Like, this is... There was a thread from... I want to say... Oh, boy. Who was the thread from? I think it was a Minofsky article, who is an anime and manga, like, critic on Twitter. Minofsky, M-I-N-O-V-S-K-Y article. It's a Gundam joke because Minofsky particles are a big thing. he made a thread that was, like, about how important it was that science fiction have what at first feels like seemingly meaningless or in, you know, non-allegorical visuals that you can just be stopped in your tracks by something, and then later you can come back to it and, like, try to unpack it. But just, like, why the fuck are there big heads in the orange smoke in Vegas is like one of the things that science fiction can do that can just totally floor you as a viewer and kind of decenter you so that you are experiencing the film in a different way than if you were just like, oh, then he comes to Vegas, and then he goes to see Deckard. Like, that's just not as good. But the scene that I'm going to call out is the sequence where I believe it is Deckard being interrogated by Neander Wallace. Yeah. I'm pretty sure that's the sequence. And he's in the room with, there's, like, water all around them. They're sitting in almost like an island in a single room. And the light is moving around the room, and their faces are slipping very subtly, like, very, not subtly, because they go really dark and really light, but very, like, not just slowly, like, the motion, the not just the speed, but the way color is fading in and out as the light is fading in and out makes it not just feel like someone is flipping the light switches on and off, or not just that someone is, like, turning a dial and turning off the light and then turning it back on, but it almost feels as if light itself is fading from that part of the room, and it just kind of slowly comes down to be dark. And there's two things I like about it. One is it, again, feels like a response to the lighting in the initial film in Blade Runner 1, partially because, like, that film is filled with nonsense lighting. Like, that film is constantly the Ridley Scott thing we talked about before, which is lights coming in through fans for no reason. Like, you think about...
Neon tube umbrella handles.
Right, totally. Neon Tube umbrella handles, but especially the apartment of, what the hell is his name? Why am I blanking on Toymaker's name?
J.F. Sebastian?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Sebastian's apartment, where, like, literally there will just be three spotlights pointing in through an exterior window for some reason. Or in the Tyrell office, where there was the kind of, like, gleaming... light reflected on water all around the walls. And so this felt like something Wallace would have cooked up or hired someone to cook up to be like, my office is better than Tyrell's office. It has this weird rotating light. But more importantly, the reason I actually really love it is just I think that it really brought out, and maybe this is why I ended up not minding Ford so much, is it forced you to pay incredibly close attention to facial expression. In those scenes, because the second any amount of light was there, you were looking for expression. You, like, your eyes were guided to their face because you wanted to, as soon as possible, see what that character thought of what the other character just said. And as the light faded away, you stuck with it. You, like, leaned forward like someone looking out of a train, you know, looking back as you're waving to your friend as they disappear. Like, I don't want to stop looking at you. I want to see you until I can't see you anymore. And that effect, like, brought what was, I think, in terms of its writing and in terms of its performance, kind of middle of the road scene, and turned it into something that felt like it had a lot of intensity and a lot of buy-in for me as a viewer, because I was so, like, mechanically attached to what was going on. My behavior as a viewer shifted because of the way the lighting worked. And so that's why I was just like, hey, you did it, Roger Deakins. Like, you did a good scene that on paper seemed really silly and made it something that I couldn't stop paying attention to. So, I know he's listening. I know he's a big fan. But
one real quick thing, yes. He's talking to his webmaster right now, and he's like, "There is. I have found the greatest forum on Earth. Have you heard of Discourse.zone?
That's us.
Yeah. No. So one of the things I really like about the interior sequences at Wallace is that I love the, like, warm, dry, like almost like the way you would imagine the interior of a pyramid, a lit pyramid, obviously, but like it feels, and also in terms of the angles, right? There's a lot of like steep raked angles, right. Characters are walking up and down, but it feels like you are on the inside of, honestly, like a pyramid or something. And what I like about it is that, again, where Tyrell's corporate headquarters is presented as, you know, the home of the high priest of the sun god, right? At twilight. You know, the sun is always fading through the windows at Tyrell's corporation. In Wallace's era, you are now, like, there is no hint of an external existence out here. You are entombed with the pharaoh in all these sequences. Yeah. And so there is at once a greater, like, sense of opulence and power, and it, like, immunity in some ways in these sequences. But I think also, despite the water, something very dead about those interiors and the way they're lit. And I just love the juxtaposition, which is, again, like, another one of the very clever ways that the movie is nodding to the previous work and finding similar, like, using similar modes of expression to say new things.
It feels like every room that Wallace walks into was built a moment before he walked into it and then disposed of the second he leaves. Whereas Tyrell's office felt like, you know, Tyrell's office and his home, when they visit him in, when Batty goes to kill him in the original, like, oh, he lives there. He's playing chess with a friend. Like, there's like glasses with, you know, alcohol in them or whatever. And his desk at work also feels like, he built this so that this is his grand vision of what the perfect office looks like. I am Apollo on high. Welcome to see my domain. And here it's like, fucking Neander Wallace doesn't give a fuck about any of these rooms. Like, they're going to serve his purpose. They're going to make him feel good while he's in them, and then he's going to move on. And like, there's no, you're totally right. Like, not only does it feel dead, it all feels so impermanent in a way that's like, none of this feels like it's what Wallace cares about. Like, none of this, he isn't building a home on Earth. He's ready to go. He's ready to leave.
There's a gaudiness to it too that is very, very, very apparent, and maybe it's even more with his sort of fashion choices than even his spaces. But like,
I'd forgotten about them somehow.
He's wearing like a kimono in like a lot of these scenes, and it is It is both playing on the Silicon Tech bro Eastern, you know,
yeah,
eating up Eastern philosophy and kind of pooping it out as he goes, you know, the as he mm-hmm. kind of walks about the room and does his godlike routine. But it's very like, it's almost self-conscious in a lot of ways. It's almost like I clearly am
that's
amazing in so many ways, but does he really think that? Like, does or is he really, or is he really just sort of trying to hide something? There is a sense right. that I got that he's very deliberately self-conscious about the actions that he takes, at least around other people, if not around only when love is there.
Yeah, I guess we don't really see him by him. Even when, it's hard to say. It's hard to say what he even thinks of as by himself, right?
Yeah.
Briefly, since you mentioned the kimono he wears, and you know, there's I think Joy at one point is also wearing a Chinese style dress. I know that kimonos aren't Chinese style. I'm saying on top of the kimono, yeah, yeah. Joy in one
another
scene is
Eastern
wearing.
Cultures. Yeah.
Yes. There's a great article over on Motherboard called Cyberpunk Cities Fetishize Asian Culture But Have No Asians by Sarah Emerson, which is just like about the thing that the head says it is, right? Which is like, outside of Dave Bautista, who's part Filipino, and who was killed basically immediately, there are a couple of other Asian characters in the background in this film. And like, the disconnect, obviously, one, it's just like, hey, if you're using lots of Asian stuff for color, but you're not including actual Asians, then maybe you fucked up, because what you're doing is gesturing towards some exotic other in order to add a splash of color and flair and like a feeling of you've been transported to a different world. That's, and the way you know that is there's Chinese writing now. But the second thing is just like, in terms of internal consistency, it's like, if these cultures did have such a big influence on this world, where are all the Asian people at? And it's not even like they even gesture towards it. They don't even say like, oh, and of course, you know, this is a world in which, you know, China colonized the West Coast and then they were in positions of power and the Chinese were all able to go to the off-world colonies. Like, there's not even lip service paid to it. There just aren't any, you know, Asian American or, you know, or Asian actors, actors of Asian descent in any way, in major roles in this film, despite the fact that it remains, as the original did, coded with you know, Asian iconography and or a filtered down version of what we think of as Eastern iconography and language. The other thing there is just like, when Gibson conceives of the world of Neuromancer as being dripping in the signifiers of 1980s East Asia, it's partially because companies like Sony are getting popular. It's because Japan was in this bubble economy driven largely by new luxury electronics that were coming to new audiences or new consumers. There was this whole new influx of cash. And it seemed at the time that Japan had, as a national economy, not Japanese people, but the Japanese economy had its handle on emerging technologies in a way that now, like, yes, Japan has lots of tech companies. So does Korea. So does, you know, Sweden. So does America. So do a lot of places. And so this notion of like, oh, the East is where technology happens is not just outdated, but like, not just boring, but like, just wrongheaded. And so that was, to me, a huge bummer, because like, we've had lots of time to get better at that. And so like, not only were there's not a lot of people of color in that film, not only does it treat, you know, women as fairly disposable, and certainly does not give them the kind of speaking parts necessary to explore those issues as well as they could or should. It also just, it fucks up on this old Orientalism problem that cyberpunk has dealt with for so fucking long. And in that way, it was a big disappointment, because I just wanted it to, do better. Like, it did better with so many things, and this one thing, it's just like, you were not this one thing. These three things about all about identity, all about representation, big misses, right?
And I've seen a lot of criticism from trans folks kind of saying there's a lot of gender essentialism that's really to some of the story beats there.
I think I'm so far into Carolyn's read on that, which is like, the core message is anti-gender essentialist in terms of like, it's not about what a biological woman is, that it is like, I guess the thing that,
I like her hopeful
their response,
read, for sure.
The response of other trans women does not, rather Carolyn's writing does not undo or mute or silence that response from other trans women. Right. What I should take away from that is that if that is the read that I want, then it should have been better represented for those other trans viewers to be able to take away the same thing that Carolyn did. Like, the fact that they had that experience is true, and that they did not, if that was the thing that Villeneuve wanted you to take away, then maybe he didn't communicate it clearly enough, because the response, that negative response of like, hey, there's lots of biological essentialism in this movie, suggests something about the movie, not about the viewer.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And I definitely can see, you know, some folks having that response that it is gender essentialist, and, you know, sort of in the nitty gritty, in the plot beats, in the sort of
right,
in the details, and you could totally come out with, you know, I'm just saying, like, I can certainly see both ways here. You could come out with a more positive message if you have that particular read in the sort of long view versus totally those, you know, kind of in the moment, in the beats, in the
right. Like, it's a movie about, like, can we reunite this man with his biological daughter,
exactly,
and the reason that is valuable,
and women's right value comes very much from their uteruses, like
from
that
their
kind
uterus,
of
from their,
you know,
yes, that is what makes a woman is, in fact, like, there are people who say in this movie the way that you can tell she's a real person is because she gave birth, right?
Exactly.
Like, I totally
yeah.
And again, I think that the purpose of the film is to undercut that, but if so many people have seen this movie and don't see that, then that's not on them for missing the point. Yeah. Like, I have no problem with a work being a little more obvious when what it's if it is trying to be subversive. Like, there is value in sublety. I like subtle things myself, but like,
and I think this is where your failure to like flesh out the resistance really blows up in your face,
right,
because
right,
like, if they're the voice of resistance and political opposition, the principles they state are, one of our kind gave birth, biological
right
birth.
Right.
And therefore we're people, at which point we somehow wound the clock back past Blade
Runner.
I think
that they're woke is the problem, Rob. That's the thing. Like, I think that's, again, like, the thing that we needed from them wasn't for them to have a good ideology. Like, I don't need the resistance to be politically pure and right. I need, if they're politically wrong, for that to be better foregrounded, so that what we have yeah is a character who says, y'all missed the point too, instead of it just being on the viewer to make that jump, you know, to make that value call themselves, or I might not need it. I was able to find that myself, but I think that the film may have been stronger if someone in there had been more explicit about that sort of like, no, actually, I disagree with the resistance, instead of it just being a silent shot of Ryan Gosling looking at a big advertisement for the X he bought once, you know?
That's my problem with this movie as a whole. Again, as saying this as somebody who really enjoyed it and really enjoyed a lot of parts of it, I just don't think the movie is as carefully put together as you're reading it. Like, I actually don't think these are incredibly, you know, subtly put together machinations that show that the movie is undercutting these things. I think it maybe wanted to do that and then just didn't do the work.
Yeah,
it didn't show the work of the
disagree
math, you know, that kind of thing. But
yeah, I think we're going to agree to disagree on that. Like, I walked out of that film with that read. Like, that wasn't, I walked out of that film, like, or at every moment early in the movie is when I started thinking about it as being a movie about whether or not the subjective values that we have under capitalism as people who are marginalized, if they matter. Like, that comes up as soon as it's clear that Officer K is a replicant, but also a replicant who has preferences. He says he doesn't like a book. He says that he you know, he buys a gift for his, quote unquote, a gift for his, again, the AI woman he purchased.
Right.
He's making choices despite the fact that we're told that he can't run away and that he can't have choice. And so immediately for me, this was going to be a film, not necessarily about, but the lens that I wanted to work through the film with was, how do people create value for themselves? How do people decide what is good and what is bad inside of a system in which choice is limited at the very least, and inside of a system in which you can, no one in this movie lives an ethical life. Like, no one in this movie, there is no ethical existence under Blade Runner capitalism, like, at all, full stop. Like, there is, nobody is good in this movie in the modern sense of good. Even the, you know, even Deckard's daughter locked away is still
with her power
literally
glove.
Right, with the power glove. Yeah.
She is the wizard.
She is
I
the
like
wizard.
Her. I think she's, yeah,
well,
a
she's,
good
well,
she's likable, but she's likable, but she's okay. So, like, the way she frames what she does, she's like
dude
the dark giver. right?
Yeah.
Where she's like, oh, I want to create nice memories and backstories for these slave creatures that we mass produce.
That is literally
and
what she does.
Don't you if think somebody some of else this is through it, her trauma, though? Like, from things she's experienced? Don't you think some of this is her so, I mean, working she does through that?
I Boy, that's a lot to work
if what
through.
I'm doing is a jump, then also this is, which is fine. Like, I think we're both allowed this jump. I'll give you this jump right. if you give me my subjective jump.
But, yeah, no, like...
And also, I think there's a limit to working through trauma. I think working through trauma is an important thing, but I think this is worth saying, which is, if working through your trauma is enabling the creation of an underclass, you got to take the hit. Like, I
was working true. Through stuff doesn't fly at Nuremberg. Like,
That's fair. I wasn't trying to make that particular comparison.
No, but I think that's also true. I think that that's also true for every character in this movie. Like,
sure.
Kay is also working through some shit because he thought he wasn't a real boy until suddenly there was this notion that he was a real boy and then has to work through what real is. Like, that is the core conflict for him in the film. But he also does terrible shit in this movie. Like, it opens with him murdering a guy who's not only doing nothing wrong, but who is contributing to the ongoing existence of people by being
a farmer. But his kind runs.
Right, exactly.
And then he
but his kind
his soup.
Runs.
It was so rude. God,
thank goodness.
It was that's so fucking rude.
But, and he didn't like the soup, but the soup sounded like it was probably okay.
The soup
well,
was
better
delicious.
Than the grub. I think she is as close as we get to a good person in this story. But, yeah. like, I would say her gifts, the things she's trying to do, are poisoned by the systems in which she's doing them.
Well, and also,
she's basically a game designer, right? In a lot of ways.
She's a game designer who's locked in prison.
She's a game designer who can only make loot boxes. There it is.
Oh, depressing. Yeah. I think it's also just, like, it's easy to live, not easy, but like when all you can do is exist in the virtual space, when all you can do is create spaces for yourself and you don't exist in downtown Los Angeles or in the junk pits of San Diego or on an off-world colony, like you're going to turn out maybe okay, you know, or not okay, but like you're not going to be as abrasive as the people are in those spaces. Yeah. I think that to me was also what was important about her contributing directly to this oppression is contribution to the marginalization of people is not always ugly. Like sometimes it's very attractive. The propagandists of the worst regimes in history made really good art, and that is terrifying. Like I'm not saying that she's Goebbels, but like there is definitely a thing there that is like, oh, she's her presence on screen is so pleasing, and what she does is not. And like that disconnect is really interesting to me. I don't know, like, the fact that we're having these conversations is why I think the film works, because the thing that I thought I was going to go see four years ago when this was announced or whatever was going to be closer to the work that Scott has done over the last decade, which has been like, you know, going for me, my term with Ridley Scott was the terrible Robin Hood movie he made. That was when I gave up hope. I don't know if either of you saw that movie.
Oh, I recently watched it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The Russell Crowe one?
Yeah, okay. The one that is like that is explicit, pretty
explicit. He invents the Magna Carta,
and also the Magna Carta is about states' rights.
Oh.
Which you know, there's some analogy you could make there, but really, it's about like getting rid of Obama. That's basically what that movie is about.
It's a
very Tea Party movie, man. Like, it's all about taxes, and it's all about like getting rid of big government out of the nice folksy backwoods of England. But even beyond that, like thinking about movies like Prometheus and Alien Covenant, which were I enjoyed more than most people, probably like you, Danielle. I think Prometheus
I actually really
is...
like Prometheus. I do.
I enjoy Prometheus. I don't know that I really like it, because what I want, the thing that goes from I enjoy it to I really like it is being able to have 2-hour long conversations about whether or not it successfully achieves the themes it seems like it's trying to set out.
Sure.
And that's the thing, or like maybe not the difference between enjoy and like, but the difference between enjoying a watching experience and a film that sticks with me and a film that I know I want to revisit and want to keep working through my feelings on. Like, you know, when I first saw Blade Runner as a teen, I didn't see that there was anything wrong with the love scene between Rachel and Harrison Ford. And, like, it is a good thing that at some point I developed enough as a person to see that scene is fucked.
Yeah.
And I hope I have the same relationship with Blade Runner 2049. I hope that there's stuff that I never saw in it for another 10 years that I see. I'm like, oh, wow, there's a whole
monarchy is good,
here.
Actually.
Exactly. Neo-reactionary.
The Deckard monarchy.
No, so there's something I'm dying to bring up with you guys, though, because I'm really curious to hear your take. One of the big surprises with this movie for me is the point at which it seamlessly morphs back into Drive.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's always towing that line, like, because Gosling is sort of, like, playing a similar sort of, like, purpose-driven character. Like,
yeah.
A procedure-driven character. Like, somebody
Gozzlebot.
Like,
can we call him Gozzlebot?
Yeah, that he's in his Gozzlebot mode.
Thank you.
Instead of Gosland. Those are the two modes.
The first act is, like, a Blade Runner mystery story set in the same universe, but, like, it's kind of telling its own story. The second act is seeing how that, like, ties together, like, really understanding the saga of what happened for Deckard and Rachel and how that ties into the present. And the third act is Driver, but with killer robots.
Are you specifically talking about the fight scene with Love and, like, the whole... Where are you starting Act 3 is what my question is.
Okay, so for me, Act 3 begins with basically immediately after Wallace's interview with Deckard ends.
Okay, sure.
That is the end of Act 2. And we are now into the final act, which is Gosling finding what his purpose is for this one last job, right? Yeah. Like, how is he going to close out the story? What's he going to do that now that, like, his former existence is impossible?
Right.
And the answer is to reenact the fight scene from Driver.
I was going to say, or from Drive, the from ocean Drive. One, right? The one at the
yeah,
the one at the beach, right?
Yeah, literally, like, drive someone off the road and then have this, like, really epic and brooding, like, I can't remember if there was a fight in Drive, to be honest,
no, I think
or whether
drowned.
He just knocked
he
him
just...
into the ocean.
Yeah.
But this is, I kind of liked it. It was just so, it felt like it was almost like the movie had turned into something else. And I'm not sure that's a bad thing, but I was surprised at both how directly the movie is sort of echoing what we saw in Drive, which is that Gosling goes into sort of a terminal dive. Like, he no longer has any hope of him getting out of the situation, so he's going to take out as many enemies as possible on his way down. And then literally we have him basically, like, running someone into the Pacific Ocean off the coast of Los Angeles.
Right, it's literally the same place. That's true.
Yeah. But what I do love about the sequence, though, in addition to just the claustrophobia of the interior of that flooding car, it really does feel like... Okay, so one of the things I kind of dig about the Pacific Ocean is just that, like, at night, that is a menacing ocean for reasons I can't fully, like, it's different than the Atlantic. Like, if you stand on, like, the California coast, there is just an expanse of, like, utter darkness. And, like, it feels like the world just ends. Like, it just sort of falls off.
Right.
And, like, literally that is where this fight takes place. They are on some sort of, like, concrete, like, berm instead
weird.
Of a beach. And
it's
the world
hard
falls
to tell-
off.
It's hard to tell, right? It's hard to tell where there is solid ground, and I don't just mean because the ocean is there. Like, you're right, it feels like the world is flat. Like, at some point there's ocean, then there's this thing that they can stand on, and then beyond that there is nothing. What a interesting way to end. Like, and specifically for me, the thing that was such a relief about was that the Roy Batty Deckard fight scene is similarly strange and hard to parse and, like, hard to work out who you're rooting for, if anybody. And then my fear with this film had been, again, like I was saying, was that it would be a more modern Ridley Scott film. But specifically, the other way about that is, like, a more modern action film. I expected rapid cuts. I expected, like, over choreographed fight sequences. And I'm so relieved we didn't get that film.
Jason Bourne in here, for sure.
Right, which I like Jason Bourne movies, but that's not what I wanted from this film. Like, I wanted something that was slowly paced and that when fighting happened, it felt dangerous and felt hard to predict. Like Danielle, you and I this year both got a kick out of
Atomic Blonde. Fuck, what was
Atomic Blonde's yes. fight scene, which is similarly brutal, but is also still a little more aestheticized. A little more clear. You could see what's happening. You see every bloody blow. Whereas here, this fight scene is just like, there's a lot you miss. There's a lot of like, who just got stabbed? Who just got hit? Like, they're both just taking it out on each other, and it sucks, and I love it.
Yes. Yeah, it's really
What did you think, Danielle? As the professional, as the person here who's been in more fights than either of us.
I really liked it a lot. It served well as something of a climax, at least in terms of you know, the action part of our half action, half art house movie that has been the Blade Runner tradition ever since.
Yeah.
I found it very, very satisfying and very, very well choreographed without feeling overly choreographed, like you said, and brutal in the right way. Which so few movie fight scenes actually kind of make you feel that. They actually make you feel the weight of a punch or the weight of a kick or just how miserable the feeling of drowning could be or the feeling of just getting beat up, just how absolutely miserable and painful that feeling is. I dug that. Of course, I like the violence. I mean, you know, shocker. But it does make me think a little bit... I don't know. I don't know yet how I feel about Love as a character.
Me either.
Don't really know where I stand on her and how much agency she has, how much she is an homage to Rachel's character, even if she was absolutely, you know, took completely different actions. But something about the way she moves, something about the way she looks, something about the way she is sort of the right-hand man of the corporate mm-hmm. jerk, you know, at least at first. She feels like a mirror image, like a really unhinged Rachel in a lot of ways.
Right.
But I really am still kind of working through my feelings on where she fits.
She is the character who I'm most curious about what I feel about her in a decade.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this is the same thing that happened with Blade Runner. So many of the smart, criticisms and the smart unpackings of Blade Runner took years to come out, right?
Yeah.
And as especially from a mass audience, right? Like it took a long time for people to like Blade Runner at all, enough for there to be a Blade Runner 2049 get greenlit and have a budget and have an up and coming director who you know is just poised to you know move over into the mainstream.
God, yeah. And if I could just put its reins. Tiniest aside, I promise this will be super quick. I remember in grad school taking some screenwriting classes, and one of the books I used was from an earlier time, and it was definitely, well, you know, looking at genre blending, Blade Runner was such a, you know, just not a success. It really just failed in both its noir and its sci-fi. And it was always so funny to me to read that in the, you know, mid-2000s being like, what are you talking about? Little aside.
No, that's great.
So it was like a textbook, like, don't do this, kids.
In a textbook, yeah.
Right. The most influential cyberpunk film that ever came out. Yeah, don't do that. But no, that's the same thing. It's like, I'm curious what I'll think about Love in a decade because I just can't quite... Every take I see on her, whether it's celebratory or critical, has left me wanting more. Like... I've seen people say that she is the mean bitch heart of the true like woman protagonist of this film, and I've seen people say that she is like the best example of how poorly the film treats women. And I don't know. And even beyond the reputational stuff, I don't know what to feel about her.
Yeah.
Also, just she might also be the actual only true revolutionary. In the film, because one of the things she says, like when she deals with the police captain, is something to the effect of, you see a change coming and your little mind can't come, or something like that. But like, Love has a different agenda, and I'm not sure it's Wallace's. Like, yeah, Wallace wants biological birth because he wants to mass produce his slaves.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's what Love wants. What Love seems to want is maybe a more fundamental trend, like. Transformation and like is Wallace the end to that mean? Because again, like there are scenes that like heavily imply she is working on her own recognizance toward her own ends. So I do think like she is kind of she's at once Rachel and a little bit of Gaff, an oddly omniscient character whose motivations are completely a black box.
Well, she doesn't leave little unicorns. She leaves cluster bombs.
Little dead bodies.
Behind.
Yeah.
That's how she, yeah, that's she does. She leaves little dead bodies yeah. around. That's how Kay knows.
That I know what's in your head because yeah. I blew it apart.
Totally. That's yeah, I don't know. I think she's interesting. And the thing about her character when I left that movie was I definitely felt like, again, a decade from now, not just I'd feel different, but I'd like slap my forehead, I'd face palm and be like, oh, how didn't we know at the time? Why didn't we talk about love like XYZ? How had we not figured out what was happening with that character? Again, either for the benefit of the film's, you know, the strength or towards its weakness. Like, who knows? Such an interesting and a great, fantastic acting
yeah.
On the part of Sylvia Hoeks. Like, just super chilling. This is a movie that, like, we already talked about how affectless Gosling can be, but, like, we should really be talking about how affectless, but also how driven Sylvia Hoeks was as love.
I want to read probably more about her. My favorite woman performance in the movie. Next to Robin Wright, I actually think she did a lot more with a fairly thankless role
than.
So one of the things I said at the start here was that I was worried that I liked that Villeneuve sort of had maybe an icier view of both film and just the genre. And that there would not be as much urge to sort of sanctify or romanticize what Blade Runner is. And I say that, but then I think about the final image of the film, or the final moments of the film, which is a character I'm having a hard time squaring with what I know of the Blade Runner universe and its aesthetic. And you said that it's literally the final shot of Cowboy Bebop, which it basically is. But we have a character, his noble work completed, expiring in the snow, heavily implied, expiring in a freshly fallen snow, and we get a god's eye view of this character as implied their soul ascends to grace.
right, the slow zoom out, basically.
Right, and I'm like, is this Blade Runner?
I don't know, right? Like, it's hard to say. I don't think his soul ascends to grace. Like, that's the, and then maybe that's the more nihilistic take is like, you idiot, you didn't win anything. You didn't get anything for yourself or for anybody else. Like, whatever happiness you think you have because you did the thing that was right in your heart, even though you knew it was, you know, objectively useless, it did nothing. Like, you just didn't, there's no revolution coming. I don't believe that this is the film where, like, and then that's the thing. That was the act that made things better for everybody. This one act of humanity and selflessness. Like, no, that's not what this movie is. In which case, it just feels empty, right? So, but I don't know, like, I don't think that camera movement was insincere either. Mm. So maybe you were right. Maybe it is just not as deep as all that. Maybe they were like, oh, and that was it. He did a good thing. The end.
He did a man's work, sir.
And right. Now- exactly. And now you're dead in the snow. But I do like it better.
But who lives?
Okay, here's the counter. Here's the counterpoint, though, is it a more Blade Runner ending than the ending of Blade Runner?
Oh.
Which is, they get away, like, and then they drove away.
And depending on the cut, maybe they ended up in the woods with some cool voiceover.
Right. Exactly. Like, maybe the ending of Blade Runner has always not been very Blade Runner-y. Like, in this case, it's a dead guy in the snow who achieves nothing. Isn't that more in line with the bulk of Blade Runner than...
Well, okay. This is just off the top of my head, because now I'm thinking about this and actually engaging with it. So the end of Blade Runner, at least the final cut and the director's cut, is that they're escaping to a dubious freedom. Gaff already knows what's in their heads. Like, he already knows this is going to happen.
They're going to die in a few years, presumably.
Yeah. So they're either being let go to die in a few years, or they're running away to a life of being hunted, which is certainly what 2049 sort of implies about the ultimate fate of the Nexus Sevens. But in this movie, so I mean, we want to go really
Nexus
like,
Sixes, I think. I think they skip a generation.
Yeah, they go to eight. At least in this movie, it's eight. Yeah.
Yeah. Or is it?
But Rachel's not a Nexus Six. She's a seven. She and Deckard are sevens.
You're right.
And then K is an A, right? Is that
Yes.
I'm now not sure.
Well, I've seen nine.
In the fiction of
love
of the...
is a nine.
Yeah. Okay.
We're going full Star Wars technical manual.
I know, we have to move on. Here's the thing that I like. Here, I'm just saying this. Roy Batty is definitely a six. I love the notion that it jumps from 6 to 8 or 6 to 9 because of the way the iPhone just jumped from 8 to 10 because it is totally some bullshit Silicon Valley nonsense. That's all.
Yep.
Makes sense. Okay, so like he has not accomplished anything to an extent, but like what he has done is like he's at least found a way to be at peace with himself, right? Like if the question is all these forms of resistance and revolution he's seen leave people like hunted or just waiting to be disposed of or make them part of a incredibly ill-conceived revolutionary movement.
Uh-huh.
And so like is the ending actually sort of both redemptive for the character but kind of hopeless for the universe in that like, oh, his resistance is internal. Like, he right. found freedom, or the only freedom you can have in this world, which is internal. That, like, he has resisted, and he is dying, but he is no longer compromised with that system.
Like, the only ethical life under capitalism is death?
Ah.
It's dark, right? Like, I don't know. I Yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't know that there is a way for me to square that ending with the rest of the film in any way that isn't just childish.
Yeah, I mean, because isn't that the surface level reading? That he did the heroic thing. The lady and will now meet her real father and hooray.
Yeah, I think that's the surface. I do think that's the surface level reading. But then you take that the next step. It's like, why does he do it? And is it because he's just like... That's what a hero would. That's what joy.
Or is
would
it because those
do.
Are his memories, and he feels a connection there? Is that the?
Yeah, I think that. I definitely think
I
that.
I mean, I like.
I do think that the thought is his connection. He believes that his connection to Deckard is genuine, even if Deckard doesn't share those memories. Like he has those memories. Those memories mean something to him, and that is enough. Like there's that sequence where Deckard straight up says, "Like, why are you doing this for me?" And he just don't even worry about
he's
it. Like, I don't want to get into it. Yeah.
All right, buddy. Yeah. We had a good time with Elvis. So, you know.
So now we're buds.
Now we're bros.
Now you're my dad. Yeah,
oh, my God. Is Swingers part of the Blade Runnerverse?
Oh,
it's all an extended.
God.
Well, Tyrell invented NHL 94, which they played in Swingers. So.
Oh, my God.
He's a game designer. Yeah, I don't know. I don't have, like, I really do wish I had a nice, like, put a cap on the ending. I mean, again, the thing that I do have is just, like, oh, I have one in terms of what it is for Kay, which is, in his final moments, he knew he was dying anyway, he knew he was not going to make it, right? Like, that's the actual thing to remember here is, he was not going to go anywhere and get stitched up and live a happy life. And so, in his final moments, he decided to live true to what he believed was, like, the thing that that was true for him, even if it wasn't true for the rest of the world, even if he wasn't Deckard's biological son, he was going to do right by his dad. And like, then I'm going to die because that's what my options are. It's that or turn myself into the cops and they're just going to kill me. And so like that, I think is the closest I have to a read for him, but I don't think that means that the film leaves us with a praxis. Like, I don't think that the message is simply go out in the world and get yours, find the people you care about and care about them. And it doesn't matter that the world is on fire. At least you have friends. Like, I don't think that's the message. But I do think that the message is maybe about how these are what our possibility, that this is what the possibility space looks like right now, that the possibility space is ill-conceived revolution is being completely, is being non-abrasive, but contributing to the oppression of others, is being very abrasive and openly contributing to the oppression of others, being a person who hurts other people in your group for self-gain, or like throwing yourself at, you know, I guess maybe it's almost a little bit, God, what is the philosopher's name? What is why am I losing this? Someone needs to jumpstart me.
What's the
myth of Sysyphus? Camus, Camus's myth of Sisyphus, which is like the only meaning, so The Myth of Sisyphus is a short essay by Albert Camus who opens by saying the only question that means anything in philosophy is why should we keep living, basically? Why do we decide to keep living in the face of abject horror, of the abject horror that is suffering, of the fact that the world is fucked and that even when the world isn't fucked, we all suffer constantly. Why do we choose to live? And for Camus, it's there has to be a little bit of absurd joy in pushing back against the nothing. We have to, the only way to live a good life is to revel in the absurdity that we are living and finding some value in the day-to-day, even though we know that we are specks of dust on a planet that doesn't matter, in the depths of space that has no more importance than any other empty dirt world out there. And that, like, nope, I'm going to live for me. And I think that that is maybe the only, that, like, this, like, minor revolution, this personal revolution is the only thing to take away. But I don't think that that's going to be, like, that's not going to change the world, right? That's my problem with Camus is, like, that isn't an existentialism that leads to more, like, to help those children in San Diego.
Yeah.
And I don't think the movie has anything to say about how to help the children in San Diego. And that's a bummer.
Yeah.
Sorry for that whole spiel there. I had to find it. Sometimes it takes a while for me to boot up the parts of my brain I've put in archive because I stopped being a philosophy student.
Yeah, don't feel bad. I was a philosophy major and it's so far back and so dusty and it was before it was the classical before the blackout.
Greek in there while you're
you know yeah. It was the blackout happened
it was before the blackout
and
yeah.
God yeah
we've gone for 2 hours and 10 minutes. I think we might be there.
We're coming up on the running time of the film, so...
What was the running time of the film? Could we beat
it?
Oh,
no, that was like 3 hours.
No, we are not.
We're not even
no,
close.
We are not,
oh, that's
we are
right.
Not.
That movie was so long. I forgot about how long that movie was.
It didn't feel long. It did not feel long to me. I was like,
I didn't pee. That is that should zero pee be break the movie. Recommendation. That's like... we've been talking about reviews for a while. Yeah, you know, behind the curtain kind of stuff, right? But like, didn't pee... should be like the highest level of recommendation for a long thing.
Look, my partner was like, there's no way I'm making it through this movie. Oh yeah, she did, because it was that gripping.
Did AV Club join Gizmodo?
Oh God, so don't even get me started, dude. Okay, the AV Club, with its beautiful CMS, especially for the TV Club and like movie reviews, that was so searchable.
It was gorgeous.
And yeah. Kinja's great at things. I love Kinja. Kinja's fantastic blogging platform.
Thank you, Kinja.
Yeah, that's some good-ass Kinja out there. I'm not sure, though, that AV Club makes for good-ass Kinja.
I bring this up because I just saw a news story that said Blade Runner 2049 was originally 4 hours long.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, fuck. The final cut's going to be glorious.
Oh, it's going to be so much.
It's going to be a six-hour miniseries. That's what it's going to be.
Why didn't they? I'm surprised that they didn't release it as two films. I'm glad they didn't.
Maybe the extra hour sucks.
Maybe.
It's all Harrison Ford not emoting to the daughter. That's the whole thing. It's an hour of that.
Or it's like. It's like.
That's
it's like very Last Man on Earth or. Yeah, where he's just like hanging around Vegas. Yeah. And, like, performing with the holo.
Oh my God.
Like, just an hour of him.
Joe Walker, the editor, says that Walker says a lot of the stuff that got cut from this 4-hour cut was mostly, quote, a lot of connective tissue and bridges. And they also pared the dialogue down to the minimum amount you could get away with, which suggests that nothing extremely crucial was trimmed away. That's not what that suggests
to
me.
Not even a little bit.
This article.
I want that connective tissue. I want those bridges. Let me see them bridges.
Well, and also, this is just a really small, like, okay, this is a random thought that's been on my mind. Because, and it's related to the fact I'm watching season 4 of The Wire, which is that one of the things I love about that series is, like, it is such, and particularly that season, it is such a language-driven show.
Right.
It is different American dialects from within the same city. Just different ways people talk and express themselves. It's the music of different forms of the English language. It's fantastic. I do kind of wonder if, like, again, like, so many big budget movies move away from, like, being dependent on dialogue at all, which as a writer both is, like, frustrating, but also does that encourage not just, like, look, you can cast, like, that doesn't necessarily have to do anything with casting. You can still, like, if you're creating characters that barely speak anyway, you can cast whoever. But also, that there is if your story world has no language, has no dialect, then it has no culture. And I think it's really easy then to sort of fall into these like traps of, oh, well, we just didn't have any roles that were this kind, you know, this sort of actor was necessary or anything like that.
Right.
And I kind of feel like, just this overall trend towards, and I think part of it is business driven, making movies sort of international release friendly. So you don't have to deal with a lot of like translation issues.
Yeah.
But I think it also contributes to this idea that there's this bland monoculture that exists in films because, look, they're all just people to look at who we find attractive by conventional standards.
Monochrome in that they are all fucking white. Like, completely. Yeah.
I don't know. It's just a thought.
About this is, like, the thing that I am surprised about is that there isn't an East Asian character in this hired specifically so that they could access the East Asian market, which happens again and again, this sort of like diversity by way of like terrible cynicism, like capitalist cynicism. Like, oh, all we need to do to become big in Asia is have one Asian guy.
The Chinese characters in The Martian.
Donnie Yen in Rogue One, right, was like explicitly hired because he was a known entity inside of East Asian markets, which does not take away from the fact that I think he's a good actor in any way, and that I'm glad that he got a role. It just sucks that I've complained before on Waypoint Radio about the fact that it's frustrating that we need to like turn representational crumbs into representational feasts. Mm-hmm. But like, this is the other half of it, which is like, you know, even when we fucking win, we win because a new market demographic has been identified, a new cut can be made for because we unlock a new segment of the market for somebody, and it fucking sucks. Like, it's so frustrating because you don't want to push away the win. You don't want to push away the fact that, like, yes, Blade Runner would have been better if it had had Asian characters in it. It would have been more internally consistent, and it would have just been less white. But also, it would suck if we knew the reason that there were more Asian characters was because it would make Blade Runner 2049's ability to reach an Asian audience like easier, like, and not just because. God, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
at least Blade Runner 2049 assured us that it did not give a fuck about reaching Asian market.
Or does that, I mean, this is the dilemma about late capital, is that like late capitalism tells you that no, it's ethical that the market opens up new places for new types of consumers as being a reason to do things. The market is what's going to make everyone more ethical, because once everyone is an equal consumer, once everyone has enough money to buy things from the market, then the market will have to adjust to appeal to them. And it's just like, I don't want racism to be conquered because it increases your fucking bottom line. Like, I don't know. Sorry. We're in it right now. You got me talking for 2 hours and now
fair.
I'm about to...
Like, those are
fucking
extremely fair points. Like, I mean, I walked away from this movie with a similarly gross feeling of, does that mean my hopes for sci-fi and you know, gender equality in sci-fi and the future are actually, no, things are going to get a lot worse. Like, that's really, you know, instead of having like, you know, feeling like, oh, maybe I could actually be equal with men in the future. It's more like, no, I don't look like Joy. I'm not like 70 foot woman with a quadruple X size boobs. Like, I'm not going to make it in the world, you know?
Or even just in this world, in this prestige sci-fi film, right? In this film that theoretically isn't supposed to be appealing to the widest possible audience, that seems like it's free from the constraint. Like, it is a film where, for instance, it does not give a fuck about traditional Hollywood pacing, right? It has thrown off that stuff. It's so good. It does that stuff so well. And yet, it still fails to have an interesting female protagonist who is treated as an agent in her own right. Again, unless we were all missing a love read that is going to show up in 5 years and make us all feel silly. not obviously anyway, right? Like, there is not obviously a woman protagonist here who you can dive into what her thoughts are and what her mental processes are, what she wants separate from some dude. And like, it's interesting to see which shackles you can break first. And the answer, you know, part of it is about what the desire of the filmmakers want. Part of it is about the restrictions of film. and Hollywood, it's frustrating that the ones that seem to be shaken off of first, or the ones that were able to be resisted, were the ones about pacing and about set design and about, you know, who does the soundtrack and stuff like that, and not necessarily even the soundtrack is compromised in some ways. Anyway, like, I think that's the stuff that it's always frustrating to see which wins get prioritized, you know, where you can break away from norms, like which norms you're allowed to break versus the ones that you never even think to break, or the ones that you don't prioritize because you're, you know, part of the kind of ideological superstructure that keeps things the way it is.
And there's a good motherboard piece on this too, actually.
Yes. Now that we're, yes.
Since we've been sort of calling out good motherboard pieces on this, I believe it's titled Blade Runner 2049 is not the film that Denis, Villeneuve.
Yep.
We're saying Villeneuve, right? Villeneuve?
We're saying Villeneuve. Villeneuve. I think. Okay. There's a V at the. Yeah.
I'm just saying Villeneuve because there was a Canadian race driver named Jacques Villeneuve.
There we go.
There you go.
It works for me. I don't know how to pronounce anything. So, it's not the movie he wanted to make. That is the headline. And it is a really interesting piece that I also don't agree with everything in there necessarily, but there is some interesting evidence. Not evidence, but he's not putting together a case. It's just more, there are clear sort of through lines in his filmmaking, and this movie breaks some of them in some weird and potentially, studio building kinds of ways, and not the artist vision kind of thing.
I think one of the things that just bothers me about, like, so at least in Blade Runner, you had, like, the film was explicitly dealing with the fact there's, like, a large pool of underpaid, highly skilled, like Asian laborers who are like driving this entire economy. Like, right. To a degree, is the portrayal also racist, and is that meant to like sort of read as this is a fallen society? It sort of seems like it might be, right. But at the same time, like you can sort of read in the movie this attitude that like the people who are actually doing the work here are not reaping the benefits; they're getting screwed too. I don't know. Like again, the movie has some serious flaws. In 2049,
I want to see it again six times. Like,
yeah, but in 2049, those people have almost been expunged. Like,
right.
We see very few people from that. Like, we see very few of the people underclass merchant class that we saw in like Blade Runner. A lot of East Asians, South Asians. They've all been sort of disappeared from this world, and what we have is a very, very white story about exploitation and class and metaphors for race. But what concerns me a great deal about like failing to, Danielle, you had a great line today where like if you're going to include a trope or not at a trope, you also have to comment on it.
Yeah, or else and you're just propagating that trope. Yeah.
Right, and I think that's really important. I think this is one of the things that 2049 ends up failing to do a little bit. It ends up having this very, we will have this conversation about class relations and value among ourselves. And there's a really heavily implied like who us and we are.
Right.
The absence of other like actors and cultures in this movie say a lot. And that like, for me, I think the thing that's going to bother me about this film at like for years to come, like it will, you know, Blade Runner, it has its huge asterisk next to it, in my appreciation. This is going to be the one that I think bothers me for years to come, which is that it very much does sort of seem like, look, we'll get around to your issues. But this is a conversation.
Well, it's like, it's a conversation about your issues. You're just not part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? Like, oh, we're gonna have this conversation with white dudes about the state of women in the future.
But you're represented by metaphor. About, congratulations. Right,
about an underclass of a racial underclass who does all of the manual labor. And again, like, this occurs, this film comes out in a context in which the President of the United States has bragged about sexual assault, in which the President of the United States won partially on a promise of enhancing the racial divide that's already established in America. It is a time to have those conversations. I'm thrilled that Blade Runner wants to have them. I'm so much happier that I saw that the film that is interested in a racial underclass, that is interested in the depiction of sex workers and the place of sex work and the place of like women, but also could have done with, you know, Gosling being, you know, Hispanic or you know, Latinx descent, and maybe having one of the women have scenes that are not just about either killing people or like making a dude happy. Again, I think that is a boiling down. Like, I do think that a closer read would see, you know, there are things that Lieutenant does that are about other stuff. There are things that Love is doing that are for herself. But there's a difference between that and then having like a lens character who you stick with and whose interiority you get access to, the way you get access to Kay's, that would have made this a film that maybe holds up better in, you know, in 5 years when we're trying to have that conversation in a bigger way, right? Like, I think that it's fair to take a look at this, to take a look at a film like, you know, obviously Black Panther is not out yet. Who knows how Black Panther does, all said. But like, there's part of me that as a younger person would have probably seen a film like Blade Runner 2049, then seen a film like Black Panther and said, Blade Runner 2049 is digging into issues. It's dealing deeply with the philosophy of being, the philosophy of personhood. And I think it is doing those things. And then said, like, and Black Panther is probably going to be a kind of empty Marvel action film. And like, it's going to have cool set design and great costumes, but like, it's not going to do anything that blows me away. More and more, I'm more towards the center, in which I have room in my life for both of those things, where I don't need to denigrate the latter, which can be just a black director shot this film filled with black men and women, black people who are on the cover. Like, there are so many black women on the poster for Black Panther, and they all seem to have interesting roles. I will see. Who knows? Again, how that film does in the end, but like, I think that it's a fair criticism sometimes to say what we need is not just meditations on the problems of the world. We need people who are impacted by those problems to be given the platform to actually address them, to tell their own stories, to tell what does Blade Runner 2049 look like if it is made by a woman director, if it's made by a person of color, if it's made by someone of East Asian descent instead of by someone of French descent. Like, I don't know Villeneuve's entire background, right? Is he French Canadian? Okay, so like, who knows? But like, that to me is an interesting question to at least ask and to think through. What does Blade Runner 2079 look like if it's made by a black woman, by a trans woman, if it's made by someone who, if it's made algorithmically? Like, there are all sorts of questions that we can ask, about what that looks like. But in the here and now, what I'd like to see more of is just ways to enable the people who are talked about in our most prestigious films to have the ability to talk themselves, right? We don't need to live in a world in which, Ava DuVernay is a kid in San Diego, right? I want Ava DuVernay and other great black filmmakers, other filmmakers of color, other women filmmakers to be given the platform of a movie like a Blade Runner so that they can try to dig into this stuff too. Like, and I bet you they fuck up also here and there, you know,
sure.
Like,
everybody does.
So that's my, like, maybe the final takeaway for me. What about y'all? Do you have, like, as you look back on it now, 2 hours and 2 hours and a billion minutes in, 2 hours and 26 minutes in, what is your final takeaway for this spoiler cast?
Go ahead, Rob.
In 10 years or so, I'll probably have a better idea of what I really think of this movie. Yeah. 10 years and God knows how many viewings. I think with all these caveats, and they're significant, but I can still love something in spite of having pretty massive reservations about some aspects of it. I genuinely enjoyed this film. I think it left, like, again, obviously, there's been a lot to chew on, and there are so few major release, big budget films that leave you with a lot of questions and a lot of things that you're like eager to sit down and talk to your friends about for 2-3 hours. That in itself is a relief, and I think the thing I said on the way out of the theater was like, you know, that was a movie ass movie. Which, yep. What I mean is, like, there are so few films that come out that feel like they really leverage the power of film and the experience of going to the cinema and like just dedicating all your attention to that screen and those images and those sounds for 2-3 hours. There's so few films that make that both feel like the movie is demanding that of you, that it compels it of you, and also at the end of it you feel like rewarded for having made that commitment.
Right.
And it's a hallmark of a lot of great cinema. I think there used to be a lot more of it coming out of Hollywood. There's not much of it now. A lot of it is meant to be, you know, sort of, you know, disposable. It's meant to entertain you, but not demand too much. It was a relief to have 3 hours of really intense film going past in the blink of an eye, where yeah. I just felt that disoriented through the looking glass feeling when the credits roll, because it's... I thought it was just getting warmed up, and I've just had this entire experience. And so I still, for all my caveats, I treasure that, and I treasure 2049 for giving me that.
I will keep it short. I will say that when I saw this movie, I saw it with my parents, and they are a fucking delight to watch movies with because they are hilarious and they don't really hold back. At the very end of the movie, my dad was like, "I don't know what I saw." And my mom was like, "So was he a replicant or not? That's what I was watching the whole time. Was he a replicant or not?" Now, I think I'm going to end up feeling very similar to my feelings on Prometheus with this movie. And I actually really liked Prometheus. I think there's a really great movie in Prometheus. Yeah. It wasn't necessarily what came out in theaters or what came out of the second draft of the script, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I do really genuinely love and appreciate, this is going to mirror a lot of what you're saying, Rob, but when a sci-fi movie with a giant, massive, hulking budget dares to be at least a little weird and a little bit, I wouldn't say experimental. That's not how far we're going here, but a little weird and a little bit interesting, and to ask interesting questions, and to, even if I really do think it dropped the ball on race and gender here, and gender identity. I do think it dropped the ball on those things, but I like that it at least in some sense tried to raise some interesting questions, and I really did enjoy the movie, even if it may have fallen short for me in some places.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough because I think what ends up happening is when it succeeds on... Most films fail. When it comes to gender and race.
Yes.
Right? Like,
well, most films so like fail so hard that it never even occurs to you to really consider it.
Right.
Exactly. I mean, this is like I think about in the Democratic primaries leading into the 2016 election, how harshly Black Lives Matter critiqued Bernie Sanders. And I like 100% was like, yeah, I want to critique Bernie Sanders, even though I'm someone who was supporting Sanders at the time. And when people were like, well, why would you do that instead? Like, why aren't you criticizing Hillary Clinton? And I was like, I have feelings about Hillary Clinton and race already, sir. Like, I do not, my guy, I am not going to win Hillary Clinton over. I'm not going to push Hillary Clinton into a position where I can imagine her being better on race, actually. Like, and I have higher hopes that that in general, the movement beyond Sanders could get pushed into a place where it has to take race seriously. Like, I want to have that conversation in this space because I want it to change. And when I think about a film like this, the reason that I think all of us want to critique its handling on identity is because it succeeds elsewhere in ways that we think it proves that it's engaged. It isn't another bad, like, summer blockbuster. Like, it isn't another bad is even a strong word. It isn't just trying to be a few hours we spend
thoughtless
in the dark together.
Yeah, less like considered maybe is the
less
nicest
considered
way to put
is
it.
Yeah, totally less considered about its content specifically, right? Like, I think a lot of summer blockbusters are deeply considered when it comes to like getting adrenaline pumping and making you have a good time with your friends. Like, all of that takes a lot of consideration and effort, right? Like, we had I don't know if you remember this, Danielle, but like months ago, our producer, or our at the time podcast producer, Tim Barnes, talked about how little he thought George Lucas thought about episode one, Phantom Menace. Yeah. And for me, I'm like, are you kidding me? I bet you that dude thought really hard about Phantom Menace.
For 20
thinking
years.
Hard and putting 20 years worth of thinking about Phantom Menace. Yeah. I don't think that thinking hard or working hard generates good art. Like, I don't think there's a one-to-one connection between I put in the work and then it comes out and is good. Like, sometimes you get on a wild goose chase. Sometimes you convince yourself that the thing you need to do is put in 100 hours of work into Jar Jar Binks. You don't. You don't need to do it. That's not the right way forward, Georgie. But when you have this type of movie that does want to say something and does want to tackle, you know, issues about personhood, issues about free will and agency, and the environment. Of course, the environment is here. We didn't talk about it. Of course, the environment is here again, right? About fleeing Earth and going to the stars versus staying here and making it better. Like, all of that is here. You say, like, fuck you, you didn't do the one thing right. Like, come on. Like, you were the chosen one, Anakin. Like, you were supposed to do it, and you didn't. And I think that that's fair. Like, I think it's fair to hold, not even necessarily to a higher standard, but, like, to address the problems that become so much more apparent when you've put in the work everywhere else, and have not just put in the work, but have delivered in other places. Yeah. Oh, I'm out of energy. I'm going to go eat dinner.
I'm going to a Halloween party. We're recording this on Halloween.
Wait, didn't you have to go an hour ago?
That's all right.
Shit.
This was great. Danielle. This is exciting and good.
We did. Are you sure we did not just tank your night?
No. God, I've already in my costume. I've been in my costume this entire
time.
Oh
my God, hold on.
I'm going as a gorgeous lady of wrestling. I'm in a wrestling singlet with knee-high socks. Nice. I'm about to do my makeup and it'll be great.
That'll be rad. Congratulations. It's a good costume.
Thank you, Rob.
What's your Halloween costume today?
Blue jeans, black t-shirt. I'm Steve Jobs.
Oh, you're Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
Talking about Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
I don't have any Halloween plans tonight, so no one will see me out, so I'll be the black people in Blade Runner. That's rude.
And after all those nice things you just said.
What would I be this year? I don't have a good Halloween.
Gamer?
I haven't done Halloween in years. I would never in my fucking life will I be the woke gamer. Fuck. Shout outs to whoever made the woke gamer Twitter account. That's the most depressing thing I've ever seen.
So good.
It's so good. It's so, oh, God. All right. I think it's going to do it for us. As always, people sent in letters and questions. Those questions
got
answered.
Fucked up.
No, we didn't. I've read those questions. Those questions got answered. I promise. If they didn't, somebody was like, what's a good game that feels like Blade Runner? There's a Blade Runner game. You should go play that. That game's really good. That's all I'm going to say. I'm Austin Walker. Find me on Twitter at Austin_Walker. Where can people find you, Danielle?
At Danielle R.I.
And at this Halloween
and
party.
At this
Rob Zachney, what about
party.
You?
Living a better life on the off-world colonies.
Okay, good. Perfect. I'm glad you got out. Earth's in me forever, y'all. But, all right, that's going to do it for us. As always, you can find us on Twitter at twitter.com/waypoint, at waypoint.vice.com, on Facebook at facebook.com/waypointvice. Talk to us about this over at discourse.zone, the second best forum on the internet. Roger Deakins. I'm going to just end on a Roger Deakin quote here. He says, "We, or most certainly I, was not trying to emulate the original film or run away from it either. Denis envisioned a particular world that was primarily gray and cold, and I lit it in a way that I felt reflected that overall idea. With the Wallace interiors, I wanted to reflect the nature of the character and also contrast the world outside. Our treatment of Vegas came from a desire to portray that city as having suffered another calamitous climactic event and was inspired by a real world event in Sydney, Australia a few years ago. The new film has far fewer scenes in LA, in the LA city streets, which also contrasted from the first film. Blade Runner 2049 was never intended to mimic the same bustling, colorful street life of the previous film. Denis envisioned another look, one that was sparsely populated and drowning in pollution, fog, and snow." You can find that over at rogerdeakins.com. Shout out to Bone for letting us use the track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. You can find out more about that at waypoint.zone/BOEN. Danielle, what do we say?
Be good and be good at it.
Peace.
And sorry about the ad placements.
Thank you. Yes, actually, who even knows? There could be 1,000 ad placements.
Oh, God.
No one knows.
Nobody
knows. You guys actually talking about Blade Runner on this show?
Were there ads?
Who could say? All right.
ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.